This episode of The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
The following is a production of the Emerson News Network.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
And driving, and shopping, and eating, and working. Somewhere, somehow, they all got chewed up and spit back out. They don't taste like living anymore. Don't you see what it's like in this deranged, wearing blender of a world? Every day is an agonizing ordeal. Like balancing a pot of scalding water on your head while people whip your legs and butt. Oh, you never forget your senior prom. You think I'm sick? Well, the only disease I've got is modern life. A schnut-busting gauntlet of inefficiency and misery that's one long parade of letdowns, put-downs, trickle-downs, shut-outs, freeze-outs, sell-outs, numb-nuts, nick-and-puts, and ninrods. All making every day as much fun as waxing a flaming Pontiac with your tongue. Where even if you do luck into the possibility of some fleeting pleasure, like, say, if some nymphomaniac telephone operators with the muscle control of Romanian mat slappers agree to a little strip air hockey, it'll be over before it starts. Because some vowel-lacking, feta-reeking cab jockey slams his checker up your hatchback, and the cab is owned by some pinata spank from a Santeria cult in Wacalpa who starts shaking chicken bones at you and gives you a boil on your neck so big all it needs is Michael Jordan's autograph to make it complete. And even with all this, I still drag my sorry butt off the ceiling every morning and stick my face in the reaping machine for one more day, knowing when it's time to flash the cosmic card key at those pearly gates, I won't be in the coffin anyway, because some underhanded undertaker sold my heart, pancreas, and other assorted good and plenty to that same Santeria cult. So does anybody really wonder why anybody is hanging on to by the atoms on the tips of their fingernails while life dirty dances on their digits? And is it really any wonder that I seem deranged?
I played that for no particular reason.
Really? That was sheer coincidence?
Yeah, it was just happenstance, Don. It happened to be sitting there. Just the luck of the draw. And good day to you. It is 19 minutes after the hour of 1, and this, the month of September, the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming along, making it part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk-packing district here in glorious, beautiful, and savory southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us. It is 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. If you would like to join us today telephonically, 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached if that's the sort of thing you feel like you might want to do. It's Don, D-A-W-N, D-A-W-N, @rickemerson.com, and the text box is open as well. Is it not?
Just this moment.
Fantastic. So there goes. You can engage with us in any number of ways. You get the text box, you got your regular email, you got your calling us on the phone, you got your Skyping. You can, that's Rick Emerson Show is the username there, so that's so you do that. So there's a litany, myriad, a plethora of ways.
You could try to do it just with the sheer power of your mind, but that might not be the most effective method.
You could stand outside the building and just scream.
Yeah.
That might be amusing for everybody.
You throw rocks at the window, and then when we look outside, you could, like, talk to us in sign language or something.
And then waggle your genitals in the crisp autumn air. Anyway, it's 503-505-6964. You have to fight for space, by the way, with the woman that we... And it was a woman that we saw rummaging around in the dumpster.
Was it a woman?
When we were leaving, was it Friday?
Yeah.
We were leaving, and there was somebody in the dumpster, and it's the thing where you...
Just like head first down in the dumpster.
Really going for it, though. I mean, really just giving it all he, she had.
Yeah.
Because, you know, something we're doing is worth doing correctly.
Oh, yeah.
You want to do it all the way.
And all of the best things end up, you know, falling down towards the bottom.
Well, and it's that thing where you don't want to, like, you don't want to just stare for its own sake. But at the same time, you're wondering, is it a man or is it a woman? And I personally felt like I couldn't face the weekend without knowing. So I just kind of stood there and I pretended to be looking for something on my iPhone. And really, I was just... waiting for whoever it was to come up and just face the glare of the afternoon sun so I could see that it was. I mean, it was, let's be clear, but this was a hideously unattractive woman, but a woman nonetheless.
See, and I just left immediately because I didn't, because in my mind, the way I imagine the scenario playing out is that I will be standing there staring and then they will like come out of the dumpster and look at me and then go, "What are you looking at?"
Yeah.
And then just come running at me with a sharp object and stab me. So I just leave immediately.
I will say this, and I'll segue from the dumpster lady to Eastbound and Down here in just one second, which had its premiere Sunday night on HBO, which you watched last night, right? Season 2, episode 1?
I actually watched it this morning. Yes, I did.
So we'll get to that in a second. Coming up in today's Rick Emerson radio program, we have a penis watch, double snuff watch, not just a single. No. It's a double snuff watch today. Clown watch. We also have another installment of The Greatest Songs Ever Made that's coming up later on this hour. And we've got, so this is one of our recent innovations. And when I say innovations, I mean I think like everybody else is doing like 100 years ago. So you go to rickemerson.com/pictures. I mean, you can do it now if you want, but I'm just saying later on we'll have some visual aids for something that I got in the mail yesterday. Because I got tired of us doing that thing where we would say, "Hey, Don, look at this photo. Isn't it great? Isn't it amusing? Don't you find it compelling and interesting?" And you say yes, and I say, "Now, if you were here in the studio, what you'd see in this picture is..." I mean, so after like 12 years of doing this show here in Portland, I've realized that I probably should find a way to either let people actually see the photo that we're talking about or just, you know, not do that. So I've chosen the former via my miraculous iPhone.
So you're growing. You're growing and changing.
That's right, Dawn. I'm evolving as a human being. I'm self-actualizing, as Maslow would say. Hey, I have a question. This is a thing. I could lie and say that a text box prompted me to make this observation, but it didn't. This is my own head. So just now at the beginning of the program, am I not correct? Are we not men? We are Devo. Am I not correct when I say that... is there not a secondary or tertiary definition of savory, which just means enjoyable, not so much salty or meaty?
Well,
when I say savory Southeast Portland, I was just thinking, because it's delectable in its own figurative way. Well, I can say it's not salty, right?
Well, there would be something I'm assuming, which would be the opposite of unsavory.
Yeah, which is undesirable.
And unsavory is something unpleasant or undesirable, so therefore something savory would just be something that was desirable and pleasant.
Because they say that thing of like, well, it's a mixture of sweet and savory. And so therefore I've always assumed, maybe incorrect, I'm going to look it up right now.
Okay.
I've always assumed that it meant salty. While I'm looking that up, what stories are you following for the good people of Portland?
We had another robbery at another check cashing store last night. A Mexican mayor and his aide were stoned to death by a drug cartel. And Google has been convicted of defaming a French user by linking his name to rape.
Oh. You know, when you started saying Google has been convicted, I don't know what I was thinking, but when you said of defaming a French man, immediately I was already queuing up the F him. But then they linked him to rape. When you say linked him to rape, you don't mean like he clicked on his name and then it was just a picture of rape?
Almost, pretty much, kind of, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll find out, I guess.
We'll
I guess it's
yes.
Why they call it a tease. And this is all true. So, penis watch, snuff watch, clown watch, coming up today. Greatest songs ever made, the rape story, and some other stuff. Plus, we'll go through this visual aid that I got in the mail. But here's savory, by the way. Okay, there's more definitions for this than I ever would have guessed. This is from the dictionary that's just on my Mac, but I think that's the Merriam-Webster dictionary. I could be wrong about that. I don't think Steve Jobs like has his own words or whatever. Savory, one noun. Well, that surprises me right out of the gate that the primary definition of savory is a noun and not like an adjective. I don't understand anything in this life anymore. Noun.
Yes, it is, because there is such a thing as a savory.
Yeah, but I didn't think that would be but you never hear it used that way. It's always used as
an
adjective.
It's more of a British thing.
An aromatic plant of the mint family.
That's right.
Used as a culinary herb. It is a genus Cetirrhea. Cetirrhea. Family, blah, 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 several species, yada, yada. Definition number two. And it is, by the way, you're right, from Middle English. Definition number two, adjective. Savory, belonging to the category that is salty or spicy rather than sweet. So that is an accurate definition. And then we have here savory, definition number two of the adjective form. Morally wholesome or acceptable. So there really is actually no use here where it just says good or like scrumptious or yummy or tasty.
No, it would be more like it was an appropriate activity.
Yeah.
You'd say that. So when you say that that this area is savory. Basically, you're meaning that it is morally wholesome.
Yeah. So there we
and
go.
And compared to many other parts of Southeast Portland, it actually kind of is.
We're not Lents, Dawn. We're not savages. We walk upright here.
We've got the Taoists across the street.
I'm sorry?
We have a Taoist martial arts academy right across the street.
I thought to be... Is that the thing that everybody says Tao, but it's Tao?
Yes.
I thought that to be Tao was to, like, just be sort of, like, to be mellow with everything, to, nothing bothered you.
No, that's,
being
that's
zen.
More Zen.
Oh,
Tao actually means the way, and so there is a... I actually know what Taoism is all about, but I'll stop talking now.
Thank you. All right. Well, in any event, hey, you know what there ought to be? I'm going to write a book just called The Zen of Fighting. You know, like something that's the opposite of Zen, like the Zen of Stress.
Yeah.
The Zen of Agita. The Zen of Anger. All right.
Sounds like a great album name, The Zen of Agita.
All right. By the way, you heard that right here. That is a de facto copyright right here in the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Now, the people are just pouring in via the Skype box here with Definitions of Savory. All right. That's done. We're leaving that part of the program now. It's over now. So anyway, the only thing I'm going to say further before we move on is I actually have a question for you, and I have a question in two parts, and then I have one observation before we move on to anything else.
Keep in mind, I'm easily confused today, so.
Well, I was going to get to that, but we might as well just address that out of the gate. So,
okay.
You, as somebody who might have heard, if anybody heard Legion of News last hour, you might have heard me observe that Dawn seemed a little bit agitated today. But you said that it had something to do with driving in, and it was something that happened in your car, but then I know you were up really late because Patrick was, I don't know, vomiting up his throat lining or something.
Yes.
Your husband, I had this email from me last night. They said that Patrick was sick, and you were getting behind and stuff because you were having to take care of your ailing husband.
Yeah.
But then you walked in this morning, and you did this thing where you were just sort of, I won't even say stomping around. You were just sort of really stridently, you know, like walking from place to place, is striding like sort of angrily in whatever way that putting one foot in front of the other can be angry. And then you were doing what I referred to as a sort of, they were like little geysers of sound, almost like it was like a cotton ball version of Tourette's, where instead of screaming or squeaking or squawking or going ah, ah, or, you know, or whatever, you were just kind of going and it was like
the lid on my my anger pressure cooker is starting to come unhinged, and bits of steam are escaping.
Or like you were doing some sort of crane style kung fu, but just like in the practice place with a stick, where you're just sort of striding across the room, going, you know, hook, guard, dodge, parry, thrust, ah, ooh, ah, ah. And it was like as you would open up the computer monitor this morning, you'd go like, yeah, ah, and then you'd watch to the printer and you'd go, kick, kick, go. Oh.
Well, I was that partly was because I was running a little bit late and got in here and like immediately, like, I'm going to sit down, I got to get all the news printed out. And immediately, first thing, your printer's not behaving
and
properly.
It did actually say, by the way, I don't know about you, but on my end of things, it actually did say paper jam, and I swear to Christ, there was no paper jam.
No, it just kept spitting out like reams of unprinted paper over and over and over again, and no matter what button I pushed or what I did, it wouldn't stop doing that.
Yeah. There needs to be a button on computers and on printers that is the stop doing that button.
Yes.
And it would just be whatever the current process is, stop it. Or contrarily, maybe whatever I last asked you to do, like whatever command I just issued by pressing a button, undo that thing. Just a big red octagonal stop now button.
Yes.
Anyway,
exactly.
So the printer was spewing out paper, and you were just sort of stalking around the room. I said, hi, Don. You said, hi. And then you were dabbing at your forehead with a handkerchief.
I was very sweaty. Well, it's also very humid and very hot outside. And plus, I was just very... I don't know. What happened?
You were just pissed off. You just seemed angry at everything.
I had this weird experience, and I don't know. Again, I know that you yourself have admitted on the radio that you suffer from anxiety at times.
Yes.
So I don't know what form yours takes. But the thing is, I've been feeling great. I've been really happy, and life has been. And actually, without going into details about my ridiculous life, actually lately it seems like things are starting to kind of fall into place. Things are coming together. I'm actually getting. You know, things are making sense. And this is great. And I've been feeling really good and really kind of mellow and very zen and very Taoist. But I was driving in here today, and So I don't know what it was. One little tiny thing happened, and it was a very tiny little thing. And then the next thing that happened was something popped into my mind about something to be worried about. It was actually, I think the first thing was thinking about, like, oh, crap, it is now like 10 after 11, and I didn't write that pop culture authority. Gah! And what it did was it just set off this sort of domino effect in my mind where I started thinking about these things that, and that started making me feel really anxious while I was in the car. And I realized, even as it was happening, that it was sort of ridiculous that, like, the last few days, yeah, I've been feeling awesome and great. So why all of a sudden, like, right now is all of this stuff, like, this emergency, this tragedy, this horrible thing? I knew it was just something weird that was going on in my own head.
Do you get the weird, the domino effect, where it's like it's like the princess and the pea, but in your mind, where everything is fine, everything is dandy, but then, like, the tiniest thing happens. I can't find a bobby pin, and then suddenly it's like it just spirals out of control.
Yeah,
and you're aware. You're going, right now in my head, craziness is happening at this instant, and you can sort of step back and see the craziness happening in your brain as you are just becoming anxious or unnerved or grouchy or manic or whatever. And you sort of witness it unfolding, like you can see all the dominoes tumbling, and yet you are just incapable of just stopping it.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it was. I started feeling that kind of gut-clenching feeling, in my diaphragm, where you feel anxious.
Yeah, I don't know what that's like at
all. I was, like, worried about stuff, and I just, like, was going, okay, stop this. This isn't based on anything. And at the same time, I'm listening to NPR, I'm listening to Talk of the Nation, and they start doing the story, which I started ranting to you about when
seriously,
I
was sitting in the studio, and I'm just... I mean, just minding my own business, as they say. And I'm, like, typing away, and I'm, like, answering email. And, dear listener, thank you for... your patronage is appreciated. Love, Rick. And then Dawn is across the table screaming from me about this story about how women are earning as much as, if not more, than men in the workplace sometimes, and how this has resulted in male self-esteem issues, and men are, having to deal with their own egos, that they're being outdrawn, which is fundamentally ridiculous and whatever. But it's like just struck some nerve with you. It was like the Holocaust. It was like you were just on a tear about it.
Well, the thing is, it was like there was this kind of anxiety thing I was having, and plus the anger response as well. There was, and like when we first started the show, I just was having so much trouble corralling that. And it's, like, gone now. I feel great now. But I was just, like, there was the story about how it was 113 degrees in Los Angeles yesterday. And our first sound clip from some random person who lives in L.A. And she says, and the soundbite is her saying, it doesn't usually get this hot in September. And then he goes, yes, because this is a story about how it was 113 degrees. It was the hottest it has ever been recorded in Los Angeles, ever. And then the first quote is, it doesn't usually get this hot. Well, no, it doesn't usually get this hot in Los Angeles, ever. It was a record high. And that just infuriated me. It absolutely infuriated me.
Here's the thing is, I actually hadn't made that connection. That had never... this is how you and I are different. I had immediately seized on her second soundbite. See, now I feel like we have to play them. Let me just see if I could drop this down here. Here's the first soundbite where she...
It usually is hot in September, but, like, in the 90s. But see, our summer, we didn't even have a summer weather.
So it's usually not this hot down. It's usually in the 90s. It's usually not record-breaking, which I think goes without saying. I was all about her thing.
It's like I opened up the door of an oven.
So I was angry that she just devolved into cliche. You're angry at the thing that actually makes more sense, which is her fundamentally illogical statement that it normally isn't this hot in September, when the guy just said, like, 2 seconds earlier, it's the hottest it's been in human history, like in recorded time.
Yeah, as long as we've been keeping records of these things. And plus, they're saying it may have actually been even hotter, because the mercury in, like, the thermometer that they have, the official Weather Service thermometer that measures it, at 113 degrees, it just stopped working. So it may have even gotten even hotter. It is literally the hottest it has ever been recorded in Los Angeles yesterday. And the first thing out of this one, it's not usually this hot in September. So I'm sitting here, and I just start going, gah! And you're sitting across the table just going, I saw that look on your face of, like, oh, my God, I have got to reel her in, because she's about to explode.
Yeah.
She's about to completely explode.
Well, you saw a series of looks on my face this morning, probably. The first was, like, at 11:45 as we're prepping for Legion of News. And it was that thing where it was that, like, where you do the little clenching of the mouth and you go, okay, it's going to be one of these today.
Well,
it's going to be day.
I was still wrestling with the printer, and it was, like, 15 minutes to air, and I was, you know, under the best of circumstances, I would have been tense. But today was not the best of circumstances.
And then, like, right out of the gate on Legion of News, you and I normally have, you know, the hardest thing, and I almost don't want to talk about it out loud because it's such an ethereal, magical thing that it's hard to get. But you and I have really good timing, which is difficult. And that's not a thing. I mean, you can improve on it. Having good timing is like being a really talented writer or musician, in my opinion. In that if you're good, you can become great by working at it. But if it's not there to begin with, yeah. It's like there's nothing you can really do. So you and I have known each other for a fair piece of time now, and you know the show sounds really great and whatever. But every now and again, it's like we'll come out of the gate and we're just like walking on each other and just butting up against one another and stepping on it. I interrupt your punchline, you interrupt my observation and whatever. And it's like from story number one in Legion of News, I'm like, so anyway, Don, I said, and you're like, and another thing, and you just. And it was like my punchline was sort of like a, my punchline was, you know what it was? It was like seeing a brightly and shinily wrapped bauble put on the ground in front of me and then stomped on. It was like, I was just crafting that punchline to deliver to the audience. You're like, well, you're not going to get to do it because I'm going to step on it. Wham! I actually said, only one of us can be angry right now, yes. And it just can't be you, which is not even really true.
No.
It was just the easiest and the simplest way to go like, you need to ease down a little bit.
And it was a lot more humane than just coming over and hitting me in the head with something
heavy.
Teasing
you.
Yes.
Anyway, all
just,
right.
Just getting a tranquilizer gun and shooting a dart at me.
Shoot her! Well, in any event, so your night was basically spent cleaning up Patrick's sick.
Well, it wasn't even, yeah, he didn't really, the throwing up was minimal, but it was mostly just, I had this really horrible cold last week, and I don't know if this is like the same virus that's finally come around to him or just a different one, but, you know, he, like many men who rarely get ill, when he does get sick, it's like, you ever see these movies where somebody gets shot? And they're like on a big bank job or they're in a hostage situation, right. And they can't get them to the doctor. So they just kind of wrap them up and they lay them on the couch and they, you know, they lay them in a corner somewhere and it becomes infected. So they start running a fever and then, you know, and kind of thrashing about and everybody's going, come on, Jimmy, hold on. We'll get you to a doctor. He had like a head cold and he was like that. He was just laying stretched all the way out on the couch, just watching TV and going, everyone's just going, and I look at him and go, now you feel like, it's bad. It's bad. And it's like, really? And this morning it's like, yeah, I threw up. I feel good now. And he goes off to work. But last night, I swear to God, you would have thought
men become infants when they're sick.
It was ridiculous.
That's the thing. Is like, and I think that I am aware of that men, just typically speaking, men, when they become ill, just turn into babies. I mean, it really is just like you see the way that we would be if there was, you know, if there was some sort of super virus that came through. Men would be the first ones to go because we just sit there and go, oh, I can't get up yet. You know, and women have the childbirth thing and the, you know, also taking care of their whiny ass men. And so that's why I try to never be sick and why I just power through it, because I know that if I give into it, I become that. I become a squalling man baby who just sits on the couch and whines.
Well, I think it also gets worse because he's almost never sick. He is one of the hardiest of God's creatures. He comes from the sort of stock, like, you know, he's the spitting image of his grandpa who was like chopping wood at 90. So he's just one of those
kind
of guys.
So when it hits him, it's like a super bug.
So then, well, no, what it is I think he just doesn't know how to deal with it because he's like almost never sick. So even though it's a minor illness, it's like, oh, I don't feel bad. This is horrible. And I'm just like, really? I'm sorry, sweetie. Can I get you something? No, I don't want anything.
Nothing will help.
I want something, but I don't know what I want.
Meanwhile, you're just sitting there going, I got stuff I got to do.
Yeah.
Feel better?
I do feel better.
Awesome.
I do feel better. Thank
you. I don't even know what I was going to talk about now, except to say this. I'm going to ask you one question, and then, which is, I actually would like an answer, and then the other one's rhetorical.
Okay.
There's no right or wrong answer. I'm just curious. So one is an actual question, one is rhetorical. And then I swear to God, I had this thing I was going to talk about. I was going to mention an iPhone app, but I realized I shouldn't do that. So, in your opinion, again, there's no right or wrong answer here, but in your opinion, in fact, I'll make it an open, I will not make it a closed question. I'll make it an open question so that I'm not seen to be biasing you. Let's say I had just like a tub of stuff in front of me. And by stuff, I mean like maybe your ant spray, you know, like insecticide, your bleach, your Comet, your scrub brushes. your dishwasher soap, you know, all of that stuff. And it's all like in a big plastic tub.
Okay.
So you got your Raid and your Cascade and your Comet and your, you know, Clorox in the tub. Where is that stored in the house?
Wow, it depends on your house. I know a lot of people.
For you.
For me, it's in a, we have a closet in the hallway.
Okay. So where else would it occur to you? And I'm not trying to, if that's the only place you can think of, then that's fine. I'm just saying. If
most people, I think, keep those things under their kitchen sink.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Under the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that is totally disproportionate. This is one of my things where I have had this written down since 11:04 last night. Because I went, there was this, we were having some kind of an incident with fruit flies in our sink again, which could have something to do with the fact that it's basically like a little Cambodia, where there's just standing water and humidity that we forget to drain because the garbage disposal will get clogged, and so then as a result, or we just won't turn it on, and the garbage disposal is a drain also. I don't mean it's clogged as such, but I mean it's, the garbage disposal, you know, it functions as a drain, but when you don't turn the garbage disposal on for a while, the drain starts to work really poorly, and then you get standing water and whatever. So where these, I'm sure, think I live in a hovel or whatever, but it's like we did fruit flies. And the thing is, once you get the fruit flies, it's almost impossible to get rid of them. So I find myself just like laying waste with like the black flag spray, like all over the kitchen. But I go to find it last night, and I look underneath the sink, and like, it's not just that the Raid is gone, it's like everything is gone. And I hate to knock my wife because she is on this sort of thing where she's zenifying the house, where she's getting rid of a lot of our stuff. We're trying to lead a more Spartan existence and whatever. And the house looks beautiful, and that's totally because of her. Because all I do is come home and put dirty socks on the floor. So, like, anything good in the house is due to her. But it's like all this stuff is gone. It's not just the Raid. It's like under the sink is empty. And it's like gypsies have come, but they've only stolen cleaning supplies. And I said, baby, where'd the Raid go? And she said, I put it in the basement. And I said, okay, why is everything gone? And she said, well, I took all the stuff from under the sink, and I put it in the basement, you know, like in the tub downstairs. And I said, well, why would you do that? And she said, I swear to God, she just said, well, it just seems to make more sense down there. Now, there's nothing in the basement. The only thing in the basement, I mean, it's like she has like a sort of a dressing area down there. Like she has like a sort of, I don't even know what you call it. She has like a boudoir or something else. But it's like a little place where she gets dressed in the morning and like reads and whatever. She has like a little like private, like a study area down there. But other than that, there's nothing down there. There's that and there's a furnace. That's it. The sink, the fruit flies themselves, the garbage disposal, the dishwasher, the actual dishes, all of the floors we clean. Everything in the house that needs cleaning is upstairs. And I said, you know, this stuff goes under the sink. It's called the under-the-sink stuff, I think, in most cultures. And she had this. So we got into this protracted argument about where it went. So I realized that this matters to nobody, and it has no effect on anything, but I just needed an answer to it.
No, most people keep that under the sink. Right. I started this thing when I lived in my house, that we sold our house about a year and a half, 2 years ago. But before that, I lived in a two-story house, and I had some. I think I had read a thing online about, like, tips on how to keep your house clean. And it was this brilliant idea. I bought one of these big sort of like plastic caddy things for carrying tools and supplies and things. And it has a big handle in the middle
of
it.
Like a tackle box or something?
Kind of, yeah. But it's just one big open one. And I put all of the cleaning supplies in that. And the idea was you've got them all in one place, but also if you live in a two-story house, you can carry it upstairs and downstairs, and it's always in that one place. And then you put it back in the same place downstairs. You always know where it is. And the other thing from that same thing that we figured out is that it was really awesome to have two vacuum cleaners. Because if you live in a two-story house, hauling the vacuum cleaner up and down is horrible. So we actually had two vacuum cleaners. We had an upstairs vacuum cleaner and a downstairs vacuum cleaner. So we didn't ever have to deal with that.
I'm totally with you on that. It's like I have two phone chargers, you know, so I don't have to like unplug it and carry it with me.
But yeah, the caddy thing. And I used to keep the caddy in the kitchen, but it was underneath like some shelves, like a pantry area under some shelves, because it got just too kind of unwieldy to keep it under the sink. Most people keep that stuff under the sink.
And I realized that was a long way to go for just the tiniest little issue, but that was just one of those, it was like just one of those.
Just to be victorious over your wife once more?
Yes, it was just one of those things I had to, well, because I don't know a lot in this life. I don't have many skills, but I pride myself on having a certain kind of cultural literacy. I like to think that I know how the average American you know, the average person in this world of ours, how they think, how they operate. I like to know that, you know, my read on the zeitgeist is correct. My final and the thing about this, and then we'll get into the news. We got greatest songs ever made coming up. Penis Watch, Double Snuff Watch, Clown Watch, whole bunch of stuff coming up. My final thing is this. So we were moving, just as there are three things. There's the under the sink is where the, you know, cleaning stuff goes. Under the microwave in many houses, or there's a drawer in your kitchen where you just jam like scissors and bills. Yeah. And then the garage, of course, is the other place where everything goes. I had this realization last night that in American homes, probably 65% of homes have no car in them. The car is in the driveway because the garage has just become a big drawer.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're putting stuff. So our garage is just progressively filled with stuff. And so we were moving some like a cabinet out into the garage that we're not using anymore. We might actually bring it in here at some point if we ever feel like we need a more I was about to say two things that are like linguistically a more deskier. But the thing that is closer to a desk
something
than a, whatever.
Something more deskier.
Yes. More deskier is a kind of wine that I prefer on the weekends sometimes at dusk. But I realize that the garage is now just filled with three things. It's filled with KUFO stuff, it's filled with furniture we don't use, and it's filled with spiders. And the spiders now have actually taken over, and as much as I love the spiders, and they really have just, they are in the garden, I mean, like so many living gnomes, just roaming around freely at will, just killing whoever they want. I don't do anything. I look away. They're like gangsters in a Chicago neighborhood. You just look at the ground, you don't F with them, and then they bring you ice cream sometimes and turkeys on Thanksgiving, and then you tell the cops, but they keep it safe. So I opened the garage, though, and the spiders have basically just taken over the garage. Like, they've got the whole thing of, like, the webs filling the entire back place and, like, you know, they've set up card tables and it's just a whole... So I finally... I felt bad. I felt legitimately bad. I finally had to get the, like, fogging thing, the, you know... And I just felt like I was committing ethnic cleansing, you know? I felt like I was just committing genocide, you know? And I said, you know, look, this is just the way of nature. It's not personal. It's just business. And I said, have you ever done it? You turn it on. And it says helpfully in the top, do not aim at face. which then you wonder,
okay.
You wonder exactly what circumstance prompted the placement of that warning. I picture a guy, honey, I can't quite seem to... But I set it down and I was, you know, goodbye, old friends. And I shut the garage and then they all died.
Yeah.
So I did that last night. So now I have to go through and just clean out the entire garage. It's a huge pain.
We had the party on Saturday. You know, we live in the nice apartment complex. We don't have to really deal with a lot of stuff. But our front door is that like sort of in there under the stairs area. And one of the things that the they do a lot of work on like maintaining the grounds and making sure everything's nice. But they don't actually come and like, you know, maintain the area around your front door.
No.
And particularly since we're on the ground floor underneath the stairs, we get a lot of spider webs and stuff down there. And that was one of Patrick's jobs that he was supposed to do before the party was to get out there with like a broom and sweep all that crap off because it really looks really... It's pretty bad.
How'd that go?
He didn't do it, and at first I thought he'd just forgotten, but then later I realized I think he just, again, he's attached to his spiders, and he doesn't want to, like, send them away.
If there was a way that I could have just rationally convinced them to leave, but that doesn't really work, because
no.
They're spiders. Also, you know, so there you go.
And they gang up on you.
That's what I'm saying. They're mean to me. All right, ladies and gentlemen, at the news desk, Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A woman reporting to work at a Portland check cashing business was bound and robbed Monday morning by two men who had forced their way into the business. They entered the building through the roof after they knew the victim was in the store, police said Monday afternoon. They tied up the woman's hands and fled Check Cash Pacific at 8210 Southeast Powell Boulevard with an undisclosed amount of money. The robbery was thought to have happened between 7:30 and 8 a.m.
Oh, I know that place. That's right at 82nd and Powell. There's that. That's kind of a sketchy place anyway. There's the 7-Eleven. There's a 7-Eleven right there, and there's like a... I swear to God, it's called, like, there's, like, it's a cat and doggy doos across the street, and I think Gen X Clothing is right there.
And that's a horrible intersection for driving as well.
Oh, it sucks.
That's
it
like
sucks.
You're just taking your life in your hands every
it's
time you go
terrible.
Through that intersection. Yeah. Police believe the same suspects were responsible for robberies at three other check cashing businesses, including the pistol whipping of the woman last Friday. The woman was pistol whipped at Check Cash Pacific on Sandy, same company, but different location, at about the same time of day on Friday. So the suspect in that robbery was an African-American man about 6 feet tall with a muscular build, wearing a long-sleeved button-up shirt, khaki pants, latex gloves, a knit hat, and glasses.
You know what Americans would buy? And by Americans, I mean me and other juvenile men like myself. They ought to have a sort of like ready whip thing shaped like a pistol. You know, and then you point it at your pie and you pull the trigger and it goes.
Yes, nothing bad could ever come from that.
And it's called pistol whip. I'm telling you right now, it would be shaped like a toy gun. You make it bright orange so that, you know, there's no trouble.
Maybe we could interest our friends at Think Geek in this.
I'm telling you, man. Wouldn't you like that? You point it at your ice cream, and you could have cartridges you put in the bottom so you don't have to buy another one. You point it at your ice cream, and you go, hold on a second. You want some whipped cream? Hold on. And you pull
totally
the trigger, and it just goes, bam, and it just shoots whipped cream at whatever, and then it's called pistol whip.
I would buy that.
All right, I'm telling you right now. That's another thing you heard me say right here in case anybody steals that idea. Right here, you heard that discussed.
At some point, the Emerson News Network is going to have to just sort of branch out into product development.
We're going to have to open our own factory of magical wonders.
Yes.
We should get some Salvadoran kids, like right now, just so we're prepared. Okay.
Portland Public School Superintendent Carol Smith's third and final high school redesign plan proposes the district shutter one campus and shrink several others. The revised charges, which would go into effect in fall of next year, also center on keeping 7 comprehensive high schools, Cleveland, Franklin, Grant, Lincoln, Madison, Roosevelt, and Wilson. Are those all named after presidents? Are all of our high schools named after presidents?
Do the list again.
I don't think I'd ever realized that before. Cleveland?
Yes.
Franklin?
Yes.
Grant?
Wait, Franklin.
Oh, Benjamin Franklin.
He's not a president.
Okay. But Grant, Lincoln, Madison, Roosevelt, and Wilson.
Yeah, everything but Franklin, unless there's somebody I'm missing there.
Huh.
This will be like where somebody points out obvious Joe Franklin.
I've lived in this town for 20 years. That never occurred to me.
Yeah, Well,
wait, not all of them, because then they talk about Marshall High School.
Yeah,
was no President
and
Marshall.
And I'm not even sure who that would that be, like Thurgood Marshall or... All right, I got it.
Okay,
let's not. I don't care. Yeah, no, I don't have any kids. It doesn't matter. You'll find that I care very little about schools. That's what we were talking about school funding last hour. And I mean, I don't mean to be a jackass about it. I know teachers should make, everybody should make more, but teachers especially, because they deal, first of all, because they deal with everybody's goddamn kids who are just hooligans, and just little bastards. So just combat pay alone, they ought to get. But I also realize that I don't have kids, and, you know, I'm not going to have kids. So What are you going to do? I mean, you know.
Somebody in the text box last hour when we were talking about something school related just wrote, kids don't care and no one's allowed to beat them anymore.
Yeah. I mean, so there's no solution that we're able to have access to, Don. The solution has been denied to us.
There we go.
And it's, you know, and I realize that basically schools are just there to keep your kids from mugging me. You know, they're going to do it eventually anyway. I mean, like if the kid needs to be socialized like with a whip and a chair in class, then you have I'm not even saying it's your fault as a parent. I'm just saying you got a defective kid. There's no school that's going to fix that. And he's going to be burgling something eventually. So it's not like school is going to stop that from happening.
Well, anyway, we had started to talk about this briefly in the last hour and went, no, it's too big. But yeah, that is one of the things that I'm always interested in, that the whole idea that schools now, people have such high expectations of what schools are for. And the thing is that the reason we have public schools at all is to, you know, that there was at one time a huge class discrepancy where the upper classes could afford to educate themselves, whereas the lower classes could not. And therefore, they ended up, like, you know, working in sweatshops and working as day laborers, and they were illiterate. And the idea of having public schools is basically was designed so that people were not illiterate, which meant, therefore, they could actually have, you know, a somewhat higher quality of life. And, you know, and then, yes, and then you had the opportunity to, you know, make better of yourself if you so
to attend university.
Desired. But the thing is, now we seem to honestly feel that public schools are supposed to prepare all children for college.
Yeah.
And that's not what they actually were designed to do in the first place.
Well, that's because that is hand in hand with, and this is really like, this is one of those things where it's like, as we're wading out into this, I can step back and from a third person perspective, see how utterly retarded it is for us to be talking about this. Last hour we had, I think our friend Thomas calculated like 17 errors of fact in like 5 minutes in the news. So, And that's not the news being wrong. That's just us being wrong. So, but I will say this. That goes hand in hand with the fact that we have somehow... I don't want to sound like I'm down on education. But the reason that we act like schools are supposed to prepare every kid for college is because we have just somehow been led to believe that every kid needs to go to college and that college is in and of itself like a requirement. And the thing is, like, you know, in Britain, they've started to reassess this, where they've started to, like, just as Obama's talking about having a longer school year, which is like, you want to talk about a dick move that'll just lose you the support of, like, everybody between the ages of 18 and 25, because they're young enough to remember parents running their mouths about, we ought to have year-round schooling. And but Britain is actually sort of starting to reassess and saying, you know, like, not everybody... Like, not everybody needs to go to college. Like, there is a guy whose job it must be to come to your house and, like, clip your hedges. And there's nothing wrong with it. I'm not saying, like, you have to – that should be your goal. But not everybody is a doctor or a lawyer. And some – you know what? And I don't mean this in a condescending, like, they're simple but happy way. But it's like certain people who just are – you know, they are, for whatever reason, drawn to a field of work that does not require college. You know, and so like not everybody needs to go and not everybody needs to finish high school either. That's the other thing, because people educate themselves at different rates, in my opinion. So that to your point, though, that schools are told that they have to prepare for college because every kid is told they need college. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, this is where the inner socialist in me really comes out. I mean, not only am I for national health care, but if we're really honestly going to just terrify children from like first grade on, which we apparently do now by saying, and you have to pick a major by the time you're in short pants, you know, or long pants, but you'll fail. Because kids, you know, they start getting the standardized tests in grade school now. If we are going to just terrify children and teachers by telling them that every kid must get into college, then college ought to be free. I mean, that's the thing. If you're going to tell kids they have to have something, if it's a de facto requirement for a happy life, then the government should pay for it. If not, they should get off your back about it. That's just my opinion. I could be factually flawed in any number of ways there.
Yes, I'm ignoring Thomas Gill. let's do our double snuff watch.
Who?
Double snuff?
No, it was another Thomas Gill. I shouldn't be mean. He could turn us off remotely from space, probably. You know who he is?
That's true. We can't afford to make him angry because he can get into our computers from where he is.
Oh, no, and please don't do it now because it would freak me out. But I know because he's done it before when he and I have been working on things. He will appear on this laptop here to my left on the notepad application and just begin typing. And he doesn't do it to be creepy. But we were working on the mobile stream early on, and he was in Seattle and I was here. And he's like, well, let's you go to the studio and we'll meet like on this computer at like 11 and we'll figure out whatever. Like that, and the little notepad application opens as he's remotely accessing it from Seattle, and he just types, "I am here," and it was terrifying, like alone in a dark office, like in dark Southeast Portland, and the computer just types, "I am here," and it was like, "Is it Jesus?" But he's you know what he is? He's Thomas Gill, who you know, I really you know, he's a great guy. He, you do realize, though, that in some parallel world, there's an evil version of him who is like Jack Black in Enemy of the State, or maybe that Haddon guy from Contact,
yeah,
who's just floating on a space station, you know, going, yeah, you know, hello, Jodie Foster, and then, you know, like turning off power for everyone.
See, I was going to say he's like Billy Mummy, and we have to be really nice to him, or he'll wish us away to the cornfield.
A virtual cornfield. He'll wish us away to angelfire.com. All right. What are we doing? Snuffwatch?
Doing our snuffwatch.
All right. Here's your double snuffwatch for Tuesday. Here's your double snuff watch for Tuesday.
An investigation is underway after an award-winning film editor for Quentin Tarantino was found dead in Griffith Park in Los Angeles. The body of 56-year-old Sally Menke was found early Tuesday morning in a residential area near Canyon Drive, just on the edge of the sprawling 4,200-acre park. Menke's black Labrador retriever was found near her body, thirsty but otherwise in good shape. Menke had worked on several movies, including Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, and Inglourious Basterds. She won two Best Editing Awards, Oscar Awards, for her work on Kill Bill Volume 1. Menke went hiking with her dog Monday morning and was reported missing by her friends, who alerted police after she failed to come home in the evening. Her locked car was found in a parking lot at the park. Search dogs, an LAPD helicopter, and officers from patrol units scoured the park for her. They said the department has also requested the assistance of an urban search and rescue squad.
Now, did you say, maybe I missed this, what, if there was an apparent cause of death?
They don't know the cause of death at this time. It's under investigation. It's not immediately known if the extreme heat was a contributing factor, because it did reach a high of 113 degrees.
It doesn't typically
yesterday.
Do that in September, you know.
No, it doesn't. And it might not be the best time to go hiking.
No, but, probably not.
But no, she was an amazing film editor, and it's very sad.
So she edited Inglourious Basterds, Kill Bill. And Kill Bill really is where, I mean... That's one of those movies where the editing is like all. I mean, that is a movie made by its editing in many ways.
And editing is a skill that I think most people don't really truly understand the thing of. If you read a book, Raging Bull's Easy Riders, about the you know, Scorsese and Coppola and those guys, one of the things you get a really good idea for is how a really good editor can actually make a movie. People like Scorsese's worked with the same woman for like 30 years. And, you know, it's a collaborative process. And a good editor is every bit as important to making a movie as the actual director.
Lucas actually, cases. And maybe in the same book, that's the Peter Biskin book, right?
Yeah.
So Lucas maybe tells the same, he tells the same story maybe in that book, maybe not be, but he said that, like with Star Wars, that Lucas fired the original editor because he watched, you know, whatever, the rough assembly or whatever it was, and he realized that the editor was editing for camp. And he watched it, and, you know, Star Wars is, you know, episode 4 is, you know, it's fun, but it's not kitschy. It's supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to be a sort of throwback to serials, but it's not supposed to be a campy film. And he said he realized the editor was cutting for campy effect, and he was like, no. He's like, it's fun, it's not campy, you're fired. And that is all in the editing. It doesn't matter what you shoot, almost. You know, to some degree, there's that whole thing of like, we'll fix it in post. And that is an acknowledgement of the power of the editor in shaping a film.
Yeah, one version of the story behind Jaws was that Spielberg's, everybody knows that the whole thing about the original cut of Jaws, they discovered that the big rubber shark just didn't really work.
Right.
One version of the story is that Spielberg realized that right away and just said, you know, haha, we will be like Hitchcock I'm a genius. Another version of the story is that his editor went back and recut the movie early on in the process to show how that you could work around it and actually make it a lot more suspenseful by not showing the shark until the last reel.
And I knew her name at one point. It was Marty something or other. It was a woman. I've heard the same thing, because it's not like I'm knocking Spielberg. I'm really not. But he, as brilliant as Spielberg is, he gets too much credit for the not showing the shark thing, because that was not his intention. His intention was to show the shark, like, immediately, and he was forced by circumstance to not show it.
And then when it didn't work, his first thought was he was just going to get documentary footage of sharks and cut it in.
Right, which would not have worked at all. You know, so I tend to believe that the editor is the one who said, look, Stephen, let me show you your version. We could also do it this way. And, you know, I'm not knocking him. I mean, you know, a good director, you know, is a guy who also hires good people to work with him. And he obviously knew enough to listen to a good idea when he heard it, which a lot of directors don't. So, well, that sucks. That is true, because editing, as you said, really is an art. And it's almost in a weird way, a good editor is actually not noticed some of the time. I mean, unless it's a movie like Kill Bill, where the editing is like a character in itself, really, you're not even supposed to notice the editing. It's supposed to, because it's supposed to be, this is really, now we're just navel gazing, but they would say that the editor, I trust that you'll understand that I'm not some crystal gazing, I Ching throwing hippie, they always say that there's like a certain way that the story wants to be put together, and it's your job to sort of look at all the footage and figure out how does this want to go together, and then, you know, and figure it out. And the editor, I mean, that's like a thing you have to just intuit more than anything else.
And also, I was thinking about that. I mean, we're going to talk about this later, but I was thinking about that this morning watching Eastbound and Down. That first episode of the new season of Eastbound and Down is it's shot and cut like a feature film.
Oh yeah,
it's beautifully edited.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's awesome.
And I was only really aware of the editing because, you know, I'd been watching some TV and I'd watched like that first episode of Dexter, which was really, really uninspiring.
Yeah.
And then I watched this morning watched Eastbound and Down, and it's just so well crafted.
Oh yeah.
So
we should put a pin in that right now, yes. Or else we'll let the air out of the balloon.
Yes. Also part of our snuff watch, Gloria Stewart, the 1930s Hollywood leading lady, who years later became the oldest Academy Award acting nominee for her role in Titanic, has died at 100. Stewart died of respiratory failure Sunday night in her Los Angeles home. Her daughter Sylvia Thompson said the actress had been diagnosed with lung cancer 5 years ago and had beaten breast cancer about 20 years ago. She did not believe in illness, Thompson said. She paid no attention to it, and it served her well. She had a great life. I'm not sad. I'm happy for her. When she was young, she was a blonde beauty who starred in B pictures, as well as some higher profile films such as The Invisible Man, Busby Berkeley's Gold Diggers of 1935, and two Shirley Temple movies, Poor Little Rich Girl and Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. She had retired in the mid-40s, then resumed acting in the 70s, doing films like Peter O'Toole's 82 comedy My Favorite Year, and then later was picked up by James Cameron for Titanic in 1997.
This is the way my brain works. This is why I realize that this is how I understand that I can be like a real dick sometimes, because I read this last night, and as I was like, I don't know, I was like getting something out of the freezer last night, and in my head I was already like crafting. I was trying to imagine like the statement released by James Cameron, and I was trying to craft exactly what I thought Cameron's, you know, statement about it would be, and it would be one of those, and on her shooting days she worked as hard as, if not harder than, anybody else on that set, which is exactly the sort of thing I picture Cameron saying, whether or not it was actually true, and it probably was true.
I kind of cut the story down. The story I had was really, really long, so I did have.
Does he say something close to that?
Let's see if I can find what he said. Yeah, because, you know.
And I don't mean to be jerky about it. But I realize that that's one of those. I automatically assume that statements like that from Hollywood are always just false and self-serving.
Well, they went to Kate Winslet for a quote, and she was very nice. She said that, you know,
she's 100. You got to be nice. 100 and dead. You can't be mean.
And I can't find the Cameron quote, right.
So there you go. I have to admit, actually, and I really do love the movie Titanic, that I was actually I won't say sad, it makes me sound womanly, but I was disappointed that year that she and Winslet did not both win, because I thought that would have been cool.
That
the whole,
been.
Like, winning for the same character thing, just because I like stuff like that. I'm a sucker for sort of gimmicks, in that way. So there you go. So Gloria Stewart and I forget the woman's name. Who's the editor for Tarantino?
Sally Mankey.
All right, so there you go. So that's your double snuff watch for Tuesday on the Rick Anderson Radio Program. We should take a moment in the broadcast to talk about one of our business partners who makes this fine program possible for the low, low cost of only 32 cents a day, and that is Castalia Language Center. Castalia Language Center, located in downtown Portland, they are a Spanish language school that specializes in teaching adults, which improbably I am. And I think I mentioned actually that when Laura gets back from, I think she's doing some jazz where she's going to three continents or two continents.
Yeah.
So she's leaving here, she's going to... What's it called?
She hasn't been around much.
Asia?
She actually does have a job, right?
Yeah. No, she does.
She goes off for conferences and learns things, and then she goes to other countries.
She's a government employee. I'm surprised she actually even has to go to work. I mean, it's like, you know. Well, you had a friend of yours.
Yeah.
And I, without being too specific, cause my wife likes to try to be under the radar a little bit because she deals with crazy folk. But he got a job at the same
organization.
The same organization where my wife works. And he was just, and I mean, he just said flat out, he's like, all I have to do is make it for a year and then I have tenure. They can never, it takes an act of Congress to fire me at that point. Which she said too, like, not joking.
Yeah, and they're both like, ha ha, we get Columbus Day off paid.
Yeah.
And they're like gloating about it.
Yeah, she's like, you know, it's like basically like Barack Obama himself, I think, has to call, you know, and just say like, look, you got to get rid of it. Like if they want to fire like the janitor at that place, like anybody there. So... That story that you were saying that you were bitching earlier about how the people on the Think Out Loud, they were talking about, men find that their self-esteem suffers when their wives make more money than they do and have a more stable job. Not true. Not for this guy.
Yeah. I mean, not unless you're some kind of just a big weenie.
Oh, I mean, Rick Emerson's fine with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so to your point, she does actually have a job to which she actually goes, but she also gets like, just some massive amount. I don't even know how much vacation. I know that she's gone a lot, and she still doesn't use it all. Like, at the end of every year, she's like, I don't know, I got these vacation days left. What should I do? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe you should complain more about how you got too many vacation days, huh? Because that's what people like to hear. Jesus. So she's going to, like, Spain, and then Istanbul's in Turkey, right?
Yes.
Turkey, and then Morocco, and then back to someplace. And it doesn't matter. But so she's going to be gone for, like, forever, for, like, 5 weeks or something. But when she gets back, so we're going to actually enroll a Castalia Language Center. Her, because she travels all the time, and me, just because I would like to not have Alzheimer's when I'm older, or to be enfeebled in some way. And learning another language, one of the fastest ways. I mean, when we talk a lot about, you know, if you go to certain places, in this city and in this state and the country and in the world, a lot of places, more and more as the years go on, every year you're going to, you know, go to more places where speaking Spanish is a real advantage. That's all true. But really, you cannot overstate the impact of learning another language on your brain. So if you just don't want to be a doddering old guy, if you want to keep yourself sharp, if you want to have some sort of mental acuity as you age, it's not a guarantee, but you can certainly increase the odds. And this is a scientific fact, a provable fact, a checkable fact, as they say. You can increase the odds that your brain is going to work well when you're an old guy by learning another language, like now as an adult. So you contact Castalia Language Center at PortlandSpanish.com. That's the website, PortlandSpanish.com. Clara Greville is the owner there, and she's a proud supporter of the Emerson News Network and the Rick Emerson Show. Please tell me you heard it here. Castalia Language Center at PortlandSpanish.com. I keep threatening to have a whole day of just Lenny D music, and I never do it. All right. Let's do a couple more, and then we'll do the greatest song ever today. Here's Don Taylor.
For the first time since being ruined in the Nashville floods this summer, the Grand Ole Opry House will be open tonight. The country music extravaganza and longest-running radio program has been making do at other venues for months. Singer Trace Adkins says its importance to country music can't be overstated.
Virtually every artist that's ever had a record deal and had any measurable success has played on the Grand Ole Opry.
It's like Sam Elliott on the wrong speed.
I was going to say, he's got like a hot Sam Elliott voice.
And I'm trying to... I always get Trace Adkins and Kenny Chesney confused in my head for some reason, which doesn't make any sense. So there were floods in Nashville?
Yes.
When did that happen?
Summer. During the summer.
Really? I don't remember hearing anything about that.
Well, you weren't paying a lot of attention to the news, you know.
I guess that's true. I guess I was just sitting at home collecting navel lint. Mm-hmm.
Adkins will be one of the performers tonight. He says the show went on, but it hasn't been the same.
We're back in business, you know. We're back home. We're back home.
You know, and this is one of those things where, as much as I'm not a traveling guy, you know, I'm content just to sort of travel inside the nooks and crannies of my own mind. Lara went to Nashville for... some, and you're right, you know, it's not just the traveling for vacation. She does travel a lot for business, too, or so she claims. I'm certainly not complaining about what I do for a living. I'm lucky enough to do what I enjoy, and most people get up and go to jobs they don't especially like, so I'm fortunate in that way. But, you know, one thing about the job is not like sending me to Vegas, as they did with her. You know, hey, we're going to put you up at the Venetian in, like, the largest room you've ever seen in your life for 4 days. And then they sent her to Nashville last year, and she actually toured the Grand Ole Opry, which I was legitimately jealous of. She brought me back a shirt from WLS, which is the Opry radio station.
I don't have a lot of traveling that I really have a burning desire to do, but I would like to go to Nashville. I'd like to go to Memphis.
Yeah.
I'd like to see Graceland
before
I die.
Me too. And see, that's the thing she doesn't want to see. This is the weird thing, is that she went to the Grand Ole Opry, and she went to the Grand Ole Opry, and I think there was some other trip, maybe might have been that one, where she was thinking about, like, going to see Sun Studios, but then, like, was busy or something. And I have told her, this is a whole separate conversation of itself, but, you know, this is our relationship in a nutshell, my wife and I. We really do work in the sense that we are sort of, you know, overlapping circles, but not exactly the same, and, you know, and all of that stuff. But where she wants to travel, and by that she means that she wants me to go to, like, Istanbul with her. Not going to happen. My thing is, though, I'm like, let's go to Graceland. And she has no desire to go to Graceland. And she's like, why do you want to go to Graceland? I'm like, baby, because it's, what do you mean, why? And it was like, I just felt like I couldn't even explain it. It's like when we were in Vegas, and I'm like, there's a place called Elvis-A-Rama. And she's like, well, what's at Elvis-A-Rama? I'm like, does it matter? It's Elvis. Yeah. And the Liberace Museum was next door.
The Liberace Museum.
She was all over
that,
though.
That's another place I've always wanted to go.
Dude, I've gone there.
And I've never been.
Oh, the Liberace Museum is awesome. And if I was still carrying a wallet, I moved away from carrying a wallet years ago. But for the longest time, inside my wallet, I had my visitor's sticker that they give you when you've paid your admission. And it just says Liberace Museum. And then there's like a sort of Al Hirsch line drawing or whoever that guy is from the New Yorker or whatever. But the, like a line drawing of Liberace at the piano looking just gay as all get out. Speaking of gay, you know what they've got on display there is they've got his bicentennial sequin-covered hot pants. I swear to God, these tiny, tiny,
oh, man.
Like unbelievably minuscule hot pants covered in red, white, and blue sequins that he wore for his NBC bicentennial special. So it's genius.
And I would like to correct someone in the text box who just popped up and said the Liberace Museum is closing. It is not closing. It's moving. They're leaving their current location. And
but
they're
staying in
to,
Vegas. Staying
it
open.
Is staying in,
you gotta
in
go.
Vegas.
It's awesome. They got the world's largest rhinestone there. It's like the size of a hubcap. It's huge. Also, it's down the street from a place where you can fire a machine gun.
I did get to go to the Mutter Museum at the College of Physicians and Surgeons, which has a life-size plaster cast of Chang and Eng and a piece of John, what's it, John Wilkes Booth's liver.
The Lincoln guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Where was this at?
It's in Philadelphia, and it's a place, the College of Physicians and Service, Physicians and Surgeons, and over the years, since like the turn of the century, they were an educational organization for physicians and surgeons, and they have all of this great stuff.
Like medical oddities?
Well, yeah, from back in the day before, you know, what we think of as modern medical science, they would do these things like collect, you know, skeletons of malformed infants.
Fantastic.
And there's this whole one case that is nothing but skulls with different things wrong with them and different kinds of holes in them because they collected them as, you know, observational tools for doctors.
Was it you and I that talked about this? And I assume that anything that has to do with crazy people, like either you or me, were you the one that was telling me about the museum that... It's a museum that is, like, in a former mental institution... And all the exhibits there are crazy things created by patients.
No, that wasn't me.
It's awesome. I have it bookmarked somewhere at home. It is, or like a, I get in like a file or something. I have it saved somewhere. This is like the document. I forget exactly where it is, but it's a museum, and it's like some long closed mental institution. But it was at a, it, and all of the exhibits are these sort of insane pieces of artwork made by patients over the years, and it would just be like the most unbelievably weird things, like. And it was from a time, I guess, when like there were a lot fewer restrictions about what patients could do. Because one of them was like he'd had like the casing of an old style television, like a television from the 50s. Someone's calling us. A casing for a television of the 50s, and then he had just over the years filled it with like crayons and bits of his own hair. So there you go. Hello, hi, you're on the Rick Emerson radio program, sir, madam, as the case may be. Who's this?
Hey, Rick, this is Jesse from outside Bremerton.
Hello, Jesse from outside Bremerton. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Hey, the museum you're talking about is the Glore Psychiatric Museum, G-L-O-R-E.
A G-L-O-R-E Psychiatric Museum. All right. First of all, it's awesome that you knew that. Second of all, why do you know that?
Because it's on me and my fiance's top 10 places to go before we die.
That's hot. That's you guys are well matched. I'm telling you right now, you're going to have a long, happy marriage. So you haven't gone there yet. Do you actively plan on going there?
We do. Hopefully sometime when I'm working on a consistent basis again, we have vacation.
All right. I put in here's the great thing about
it's
Google.
It's in Missouri.
I just typed in GLOR, and it went right to GLOR Psychiatric Museum. Oh, my God. And it is immediately to a photo gallery, which
yeah,
is creepy.
Yeah, did it come up with the very first photo of the thing that the one guy that ingested everything over the years?
Oh, yeah. And it's an art exhibit of all the things this guy swallowed over the years.
Including, dude, it's creepy.
Oh, it's completely creepy. And it's in where, Don? Where did you say
it's
this?
It's in Missouri. St. Joseph, Missouri.
It's in Missouri. Correct.
Is there anything else at this... is there anything else in St. Joseph, Missouri that would... In other words, like going just to see this museum would be fine, but I wonder if is there anything else of there so I can make like a whole trip of it. Is there anything else in the town that would be interesting, do you think?
Probably not.
Probably not, but I mean, this is...
Come on. It's Missouri.
I guess,
you want to go see where some, you know, some ruts are where, you know, a bunch of covered wagons might get in.
That's a fair point.
You know, 1700, that's great, but, you know, other than that, I mean, what else...
What else do I need?
Yeah. Come on.
I mean, I guess I really don't need anything else. God damn, I'm looking at this photo gallery. This is just terrifying and fantastic. I have to go to this.
It's
insane.
This really was, I was going to say, a simpler time, but really from a more horrifying time in psychiatry, where it's not just like an exhibit of artworks made by patients. It's like a, you know, an exhibit of the way the hospital used to look and, like, implements they used to use to calm the patients. Mm-hmm. And by calm, I mean just apparently shoving them inside a canvas bag. It's just like, it's a patient calming apparatus, and it's just a white canvas bag they put over your head, and then they knot it shut like you're like Mr. Creedy.
Like you're a canary. Great. You just calm down as soon as they cover your head.
That's awesome. We should totally do it like a road trip into a show from there.
They probably put you in a bag and then put you behind a fluoroscope, which would give you cancer.
Absolutely. I mean, really, it's like, what can we do that will not help you in any way, Don?
Actually, St. Joseph, Missouri is also home to the Pony Express Museum and the Jesse James Museum.
I'm going. Okay. The next time my wife wants to go somewhere, I'm going.
And the Society of Memories Doll Museum.
Okay, that's the next place. That is the next place we're going. We should, you know, like Bruce Williams and, you know, and those like Mark and Brian, all the, you know, like radio hosts they do, they're like, we're going to be taking a radio cruise. You can all go on a boat with us and we'll be doing the show live from a princess boat in the middle of the ocean. We should totally do like a listener road trip to the Glore Psychiatric Museum in Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
Because how could that go wrong? Oh, it's awesome.
Well, you could do that or even just like a walkthrough commentary.
Total. Oh, yes. I like what we're saying.
Because if you do that, then you can do it as a podcast, and we can all put it on our iPods and wander through the Glore Museum while you're yakking in our headphones.
That is fantastic. Okay,
this crazy giant Christian Science church that was built in 1905.
And that's also in St. Joseph, Missouri?
That is also in St. Joseph, Missouri.
It's the happeningest town in the world. How have I never heard of this place before? All right.
Very good. Done and done.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Not a problem.
All right, there you go. That's Jesse outside of Bremerton calling us there. Awesome. Best audience ever.
They have a thriving tourism industry in St. Joseph, Missouri, apparently.
Well, how could they not?
They've got all kinds of stuff going on.
Seriously, but I mean, that Glore Psychiatric Place, is that not alone worth going to the... I mean, that's... how great is this audience that I was like, there's some museum somewhere, and a guy immediately... here's where it is, and my fiance and I are going. All right. Awesome. Let's do one more, and then we will take a break for Greatest Songs Ever Made. By the way, the Rick Emerson Show today and every day brought to you by folks including The Cleaning Solution. Mr. Michael Beatty is the owner of that fine company, 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. More on that in just a bit. Here's Don Taylor.
Let's do the Clown Watch.
Here's your right on the heels of the Psychiatric Museum discussion. Here's your Clown Watch for Tuesday. Here's Don Taylor with your Clown Watch.
A Brazilian clown who is a favorite to win a seat in Congress in Sunday's elections has been challenged to prove he can read and write. Polls suggest the clown known as Tiririca will win more than 1 million votes. But a judge in Sao Paulo has demanded he demonstrate that he meets the literacy requirement for elected office. Newspapers have reported that, like 1 in 10 Brazilians, he is illiterate. Tiririca, which means grumpy in colloquial Portuguese, has been the sensation of the election campaign, with humorous campaign advertisements on YouTube that have attracted millions of hits. His campaign slogans include, "It can't get any worse," and "What does a federal deputy do? Truly, I don't know. But vote for me, and I will find out for you."
I'd vote for him now if I could. I almost want to get dual citizenship just so I can cast a ballot.
The judge said he wants him to take a literacy test after the magazine Epoca posted a video in which he appeared to be struggling to read. The electoral court says it's too late to stop his candidacy, but he could be removed from office if he fails to show he can read and write after the election. His real name is Francisco Everardo Oliveira Silva. He started working in a circus at the age of 8. He's now a TV comedian. He's one of dozens of candidates from the world of sports and show business fighting for one of the lower House of Parliament's 513 seats alongside experienced politicians.
Well, this is like when, I guess last hour we were talking about how Jay Leno's in trouble because he was talking about the Prime Minister of Ireland and he said, it's good to know we're not the only country with drunken buffoons as leaders. It's good to know that we're not the only country where the election just a total joke.
Oh, yeah. There's something like they said, it's like TV actors and comedians and that sort of thing. There are... 513 seats available. There are more than 6,000 candidates from 27 parties.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Oh, wonderful. There's your Clown Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson radio program. You know, that Glore Museum, I just keep looking at that photo of the things that guy swallowed. You know, it's just like a huge, like a pastiche of objects found in his stomach. That's wonderful.
Have you been to the... there's a museum in Clackamas County at a monastery, I believe, and they have the world's largest hairball. It was taken out of a pig's stomach.
No, the only monastery that I've ever spent any time at is Mount Angel. By the way, the Mount Angel Museum, and that's... I always get my counties mixed. I never know what's in what county. But you're not talking about Angel Monastery.
Maybe I am thinking about the Mount Angel.
How many monasteries could there possibly be? You talking about the
Do
one?
Do they have
in...
a giant hairball?
Well, I don't know, but I will tell you this: the Mount Angel Monastery, where I've spent a fair amount of time, because it's a beautiful. It's one of my favorite places in the world. It's a beautiful place. They have a museum there where they have, for example, the whale bone of a the rib bone of a whale. And they also have two cows, like, joined at, like, the neck or something.
It is indeed the Mount Angel Abbey Museum.
Okay, well, they must have added. It must be a recent addition to the exhibit, because I've been there. The last time I went to Mount Angel was a couple years ago. That's one of the first places I ever took my wife, and we moved, because, you know, we moved to Portland. It was all drizzly and rainy and horrible, and we'd come from San Diego, and she was hating me, and I said, no, but it's very pretty. And she said, fine, you know, whatever, prove it. And so I took her to Mount Angel, which is a place where I used to go to church when I was a wee lad, and I would come here when I would be with my family here in Portland or in Silverton. We would go to church at Mount Angel, blah, blah, blah. But it's in an abbey up on this huge hill, and you can see, like, three states or something. It's just massive. But they've got this museum where... I mean, it's like a monastery, but then, like, for no readily apparent reason, there's a museum with, again, like a whale rib bone.
Yeah.
I don't know why you would want that.
And there's, like, Civil War memorabilia. And like I said, yeah, they've got this giant pig hairball.
And it was taken out of a pig?
Yeah. It's
why
huge.
Would a pig have – where would a pig get hair?
Well, I guess they chew on themselves or –
Pigs
I don't
have hair. They
do.
Boars have hair.
Well, yeah.
Pigs, they always say that's why they test, like, sunscreen on pigs, because they're like us. They just have skin.
Well, maybe it came from a boar. It's a porcine hairball.
Maybe it was just licking someone else.
Maybe.
Maybe it was, like, licking its owner's head or something lovingly at night.
Maybe.
Sometimes while you're asleep, I lick your head.
That's why you should not keep a pig as a pet.
No.
They'll
no.
do that to you.
No, you shouldn't. Okay. This is the Rick Emerson radio program, and we... can't believe it ourselves. Thank you for listening. Hey, by the way, tomorrow we're going to be joined in studio by our good friend Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. So here's the thing. So Cheryl just said this to me. So we knew we were talking to Aaron. He's coming into the studio tomorrow. That's how excited he is to talk about The Social Network, which
we didn't get to see.
Which we didn't get to see because we were here entertaining the people,
That's
Don.
Right.
So here's the thing. So here's what a nerd I am. So I'm compensating for not seeing the screener by actually just reading the script.
Oh.
So I have here the script for The Social Network, which is the new Aaron Sorkin. Everybody else can call it a Fincher film. I call it a Sorkin film being directed by David Fincher. So I've been reading The Social Network script, which I'm hoping to finish tonight. So he saw the screener for that, and he is calling it one of the best movies of the year, which I have no difficulty believing because the trailers have been great. David Fincher has never made an uninteresting movie. He's made some movie. Yeah, I didn't really care for a couple of his films, but even the worst David Fincher film has something going for it. And, you know, and I'm such a nerd for Sorkin that, you know, I mean, it's that whole thing about, you know, I'd listen to that guy read the phone book, they say about guys with good voices.
Yeah.
I mean, I have. If you've ever
listened to him write the phone book.
Well, if you've ever spent any amount of time watching The West Wing, you have basically spent large portions of your viewing time listening to Aaron Sorkin's characters, like, recite governmental regulations. And in a way that you go, that's fantastic. So, so Aaron Mesh tomorrow will talk about The Social Network, the film which is in theaters this Friday. And that, by the way, is going to be the thing that gets me off my fat ass and into a movie theater. That's what'll do it.
Well, Sorkin also, I think, didn't he write The American President?
Yes, he did.
Which is one of a small number of romantic comedies that I can actually not only stand, but really like, and we'll watch whenever it pops up on cable.
Yeah.
We'll rewatch.
Oh, it's a great movie. I mean, it's just, you know, and he, as much as the term Capra-esque is sort of overused, The American President really does have a sort of updating of that Mr. Smith Goes to Washington kind of feel, where it's, you know, it's easy to view it as corny or you know, unrealistic or whatever, but it's like, but you know, the thing about Sorkin is it's like he's a little bit of a verbal magician in that for the duration of the movie or the whatever, he does sort of get you to suspend your disbelief, not about, like, fantasy or sci-fi, but about, like, government can help you. People are good. You can make a difference. And, like, we all know those things aren't true. But, you know, while you're watching it, you go, My God, we can change things. So, you know, he is like, he's just so, he, yeah, I'm.
And to the person in the text box who says, I can't for the life of me understand the appeal of this Facebook movie, I say, well, then listen tomorrow.
Well, but see, okay, I'm going to modulate this, and then I swear to God, we're going to do greatest songs ever made here in a second. But where you will then see that all my writing is basically just thinly veiled attempts to write like Aaron Sorkin. I will modulate this because I don't want to sound like I'm hectoring, okay? I don't want to be like I'm lecturing anybody about this. I understand people who say, it's like people say, why should I see a movie about Facebook? And when they say it, I understand what they mean. They're saying effectively, it's like people who say, why should I see a movie based on a board game? I mean, because they're making a whole bunch of those. Like they're making a Battleship game, yeah, and they're making a Candyland or a Battleship movie and a Candyland movie and whatever.
Or saying something like, you know, why would I want to watch a movie about Bill Gates? What do I care about? I don't know.
I think people would say, like, well, he's led an interesting life. I can get that. But they say, why do I want to watch a movie about a website? But the thing is, it's not about the website.
Yeah.
It really is. And this sounds like a dumb comparison. So I'm only saying this because I care. Because the story of the founding and the alleged stealing of Facebook is fascinating. So I mean this in a totally sincere way, that based on my knowledge of the history of Facebook and having read the Mesrich book, which is unsourced but seems largely accurate, and based on reading the script and whatever, if you liked and enjoyed There Will Be Blood, for example, then you really ought to see this, because it's not about Facebook. It's about business and business dealings and human interactions and double crossing and the way that people and relationships with people and how things start as one thing and then they morph into something else because you get corrupted by power and money and fame.
Much as what is happening behind the scenes here at the Emerson News
Network.
Exactly.
Really, and we're just days away from actually me having you. I was trying to come up with a reference that they might be blood. I was going to say bludgeon you with a bowling pin, but that just seemed too much. And then I was trying to find something else, and I couldn't.
Because I will drink your milkshake, Rick Emerson. I will drink your milkshake.
See, why didn't I just say that? That would have been obvious and funny. And instead, I was trying to be. I was actually going to say, I will make you a deaf 9-year-old. But then that doesn't make any sense. Like, I lack the ability to do that. So I don't mean to be a jackass about it. And it's like, see it, don't see it, you know, whatever. You're a free-thinking individual with an individual will and choice. But you are, I think, doing yourself a disservice if you say, why would I want to see a movie about Facebook? That's like saying, why would I want to see a movie about, like, you know, the rise of the Ford Motor Company? Well, because it's a fantastic story, because it's like the people behind that are just amazing. So
there we go.
You really ought to watch it. It's looking to be pretty.
And more to come
fantastic
tomorrow when Aaron Mesh is here to talk to us.
Oh man,
about
I'm just gonna just.
You got some paper there.
I do. All right, I'm just taking a moment here so I can get over my gayness for Aaron Sorkin. Hold on. Which isn't really ever going to happen. So, all right. Still to come, Penis Watch. That is coming up, and something else. I mean, we may or may not get to this visual aid that I've set aside. But that's why I deliberately have not said too much about it. So we will try to get to that. Penis Watch on the way. We have more news from Don Taylor and so forth. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program, and it's time for another installment of The Greatest Songs Ever Made. The film critic Roger Ebert once said that a movie isn't about what it's about. It's about how it's about it. And what he means is the subject matter and the story are important, but it's the delivery, the method, the technique. That's what makes or breaks the final product. And so it is with music. Often we find that the most powerful songs, the songs that are the most moving, songs that mean a great deal to us, is those songs whose meanings often elude us. I mean, after all, you take a song like Smells Like Teen Spirit, for example. What is that song really about, anyway? Probably nothing. At least nothing concrete or finite. It all comes down to one thing. It comes down to tone and to feeling, and those are the elements that make a song magic. Released in 1993, today's song was track number 3 of the album by a band of whom few have ever heard. The song and the associated album fare a little better. The album is, in fact, out of print, though it can be purchased digitally. Things are familiar and haunting right out of the gate, as a guitar line, which is equal parts 70s and 90s pop, sets the stage for a lush exploration of, well, something, since the meaning of the song's lyrics isn't altogether clear. The hushed, layered delivery, sometimes not so much singing as breathing the lyrics, seems to be about a lost love, someone who left or was left by the song's protagonist. In a production style associated with so-called dream pop, commonly associated with bands such as the Dream Academy, the song twists and turns, sounding as though it's being performed in a chill-laden gloom of an autumn dusk. A low, moaning reverie persists throughout the background of the song, and the vocals recall years gone by, the same years referenced in the title. And though interpretations of the song vary wildly, it does have the unmistakable sound of someone looking through the prism of the past. The song's author, who is the band's guitarist, has been very circumspect about the track's meaning and significance, but that, of course, is part of why the magic remains. It allows us to put ourselves and our own lives onto a dark, drifting, and dreamy canvas that is at once beautiful and achingly sad. From their album Ring, this is one of the greatest songs ever made, The Connells and 74-75 on The Rick Emerson Show. Not that Lenny D is himself any slouch, though. You
no.
understand? The thing about that song we just played, the Connell song, it reminds me a lot, for reasons I can never quite quantify, I think it has to do with the sort of that the weird sort of layery, I called it a reverie, but that kind of droning background vocal. It reminds me a lot of that Life in a Northern Town song by the Dream Academy. I mean, it's like the melodies aren't anything that, you know, alike. I mean, it's not like the composition is similar, but there's some sort of a weird... It does have the weird sort of autumnal feel to it that I can never quite quantify. So, yeah, it was like huge everywhere, and except for here, like the country where they're from. You can't even buy the record. So there you go. That's just the way life works sometimes, Don. An endless series of disappointments and down endings. Hi, you're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program, made possible by folks like The Cleaning Solution. The Cleaning Solution is Mr. Michael Beatty, and he was one of, and this is the thing that I say feeling like it's correct, that he was actually the first advertiser on this iteration of the program.
Yes, he
was. I didn't want to say it and have it come out of my mouth and then realize, no, what a fool I am.
That's true.
So an early adopter, an early believer, and also a longtime listener. So he's been with us as a listener and as a fan of the show for a long time. We told the story several weeks ago of how we ran into him at a Lycus event years ago at the Crystal Ballroom. And when this version of the Rick Emerson Show launched, he was, you know, stepped right up and he said, by God, I want to support you with my hard-earned shekels. And so we thank you, sir. Mr. Michael Beatty, The Cleaning Solution, and you can find out more about him. You can reach him at 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. And if you don't get a chance to write that down or you want to be able to look it up later, you can go to rickemerson.com/contact. rickemerson.com/contact, where you can find the, of course, contact information for Michael Beatty, for any of our business partners, for us here at the show. He will clean your upholstery, your tile, your marble, carpet, your entryway, flagstones, whatever those are. The flagstones are the sort of... Those are the weirdly shaped, where it's like they're not uniform, right? Flagstones are where it's just like, I don't say random, but it's just rocks of varying shapes and sizes all put down into sort of a rough yet somewhat walkable surface.
I believe so, yes.
And that's different from cobblestones, which are more rounded and more uniform
smaller.
In their spacing.
Yeah.
Yeah, flagstones are almost like where they just have a bunch of, it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle where everything is about 4 inches apart from another piece.
Yes.
You know what somebody ought to invent if it hasn't been invented already? Somebody ought to create, I've become this guy now officially, somebody ought to make an app that is like just a jigsaw puzzle. You move crap around on the screen. That's got to exist,
that
right?
That has to exist.
Because now I'm not capable of writing an application. I couldn't do it if you put a gun to my head. But now I'm just that guy who not only just thinks of like, there ought to be, you know, pistol whip that you on your... with. But now I'm all the, you know, there ought to be an app that... And, you know, it just irritates everybody. I am that guy.
You kind of are, yeah.
What are you going to do? Michael Beatty probably makes that possible. He allows everyone to hear my nonsensical natterings. Michael Beatty can be reached at 971-533-3211. And whether it's your home, whether it's your office, business, or residential, The Cleaning Solution is the answer to whatever staining or soiling or odor-fying that may have happened to your... your rug. I just have no idea. Wait, today with the making of the words, I've inadvertently coined like 100 things that are none of them intelligent sounding. 971-533-3211. The Cleaning Solution is a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Show here at the Emerson News Network. Please tell me you heard it here. 971-533-3211. The Cleaning Solution. Some days it's just a miracle I can tie my own shoes. I mean, I don't even know how that works.
So this has nothing to do with anything, but I was kind of just checking something on the internet, and two little bits of casting news for movies that actually kind of please me. Don't really care, me personally, about the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie, except Ian McShane is going to be playing Blackbeard.
Really?
And then Josh Holloway. Sawyer, one of my my top five imaginary TV boyfriends from Lost, he is going to be starring in Brad Bird's Mission Impossible 4.
Okay, wait. First of all, that's...
Brad Bird is the director of record for the next Mission Impossible movie.
That was going to be my third... Okay, I got too many things fighting for space in my head. Too many things. Okay, A, that Sawyer guy, I thought you were going to say he was playing a pirate, and I was going to say that seems inevitable. Like,
yeah.
That just seems like a thing he's destined to do. You know, the weirdest thing? I know this will make me look like an idiot, but when Watchmen came out, and This is before they revealed that all of the, like, the Tales of the Black Freighter and all that stuff was going to be a, it was coming out as a separate feature or whatever. When they hadn't quite announced that and they were saying that they thought that Tales of the Black Freighter, which is the story within a story, the pirate story, it sounded like that might be included in the movie and it might almost be like a live-action thing. He was the guy I pictured as the protagonist. I don't know why, and then probably just because of Dopey that. Lost thing, but he just has that grizzled sort of like, I've seen things no man should see look. So there's that. Brad Bird is directing the next Mission Impossible movie?
Yeah, isn't that terrific?
I don't know.
This will be his first live-action film, but I mean, you know.
I honestly don't know. Here's the thing, if I could just say, I haven't liked any of the Mission Impossible films, and I've seen them all, and I've wanted to like them all.
I liked the third one. I didn't like the first two.
Was that the J.J. Abrams one?
Yeah, I liked the J.J. Abrams
one. It was the best of the lot, I'll say that.
Mostly for Philip Seymour Hoffman.
That's the thing. I mean, it was the best, and I actually, you know, I didn't mind the first one all that much. The second one I could have done without altogether. The third one, I was okay. It was probably better than the other two, but none of them really seem... None of them really seem worthy of the guys who've directed them. I think I expect a little bit more from Abrams, and you know, but Brad Bird. I mean, I love that guy. I mean, he can do no wrong. So who knows?
I mean, I know that it doesn't really work this way in Hollywood when you've had massive success like with The Incredibles and such. But it personally, on an artistic level, I would have liked to have seen him make his first. A live-action movie, something with a little bit of a lower budget and like less expectations attached
to
it.
Yeah, but that isn't... You're right. That's not how it works. Yeah. It's like they ratchet it up until you inevitably fail. I mean, that's the way... you know, and I will say, who was it? Aaron was telling me about this. There was some superhero film that came out, some dreck, where they went back and they reshot and re-edited and added a whole bunch of special effects scenes at the end after seeing The Incredibles because they said, like... They went back to, they said, they said it was like Spider-Man 3 or something.
Yeah.
Maybe the timeline is right for that. But anyway, one of the guys saw an advance cut of The Incredibles, and he said, oh my God, we're going to get schooled by this like CGI, this cartoon, because they've done the greatest finale to any superhero film ever. Like, we got to film more stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, Brad Bird really, it would have been easy for that guy to make like The Iron Giant and then just... You know, and then either be eternally bitter about how that movie turned out and how it was marketed and how it failed at the box office, and then just never do anything again, or just to try to go an entirely different direction. But instead, he merged the best of both worlds, where he continued to make these things that were sort of fantastical, but he's also just a freaking genius. And so it turned out was just one flawless film after another. Well, good for him. I mean, I hope that he wants to do... I hope it's a thing he's doing because he wants to make that movie.
Because it's... Unfortunately, sometimes you end up with situations like somebody like Sam Raimi, who was making the movies he wanted to do, and he was like really terrific at it. And then he made like The Quick and the Dead, which was great. And then they just said, "Here, have a big pile of money. Here, direct Spider-Man." And you just kind of go,
"Right,
it's okay."
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
you're doing a good job at it, but you're Sam freaking Raimi. I mean,
well, that's but it is, and. I don't know. I almost hesitate to say this because then it's
like if the Coen brothers decided to, you know, that they would take the job of directing an Incredible Hulk movie. You're like, really?
I was going to say, and this is the worst analogy possible because then it just again makes everything about me. I was going to say it is not unlike actually when they said, "Would you like to do a show on KUFO?" it's got 500 times the power of your last station. Also, there'll be, you know, much more money and a bigger budget and, you know, and whatever. And it's the big FM morning show. It's where everybody wants to work. And, you know, and we were sort of doing this quirky, independent little show. It's in some ways, in as much as one can do that for CBS, just like Brad Bird has been making. I mean, in as much as you can be doing this when you're making like Pixar movies,
right.
It's not like you're making a huge blockbuster film, and you do have a lot more, especially when you're working with a guy like John Lasseter, you have so much freedom and so much creative control, but it's like the bigger the budget and the bigger the whatever, as we saw with Sam Raimi, it's like it just comes with more and more shackles and handcuffs until eventually you find that all of the things that people liked about your movies are essentially impossible to do in the same way when you've got the bigger budget.
But yeah, I don't, you know, keep going back to the Coen brothers and stuff, but there's a teaser trailer that was just recently released. They're doing a remake of True Grit. And when you hear that, you think, ooh, I don't know about it. You'll look at that teaser trailer. Jeff Bridges as Rooster Cogburn. Brolin is in it. Matt Damon is in it.
I could see that,
and,
I guess.
But yeah, the compilation of shots. It's basically a teaser trailer with just a whole lot of visuals to give you an idea of what they're doing. And it just looks great. It just looks gorgeous.
The Coen brothers don't make bad movies. I mean, they make movies I don't really care for sometimes.
Yeah.
But they don't make bad movies, and you got to figure that they think long and hard about what they're going to do, especially because they don't do a lot of adaptations. I mean, have they flat out like adapted anything before or remade anything?
They remade that one Alec Guinness comedy with Tom Hanks that was not very good. I can't remember what the hell was that.
I don't even know when would this have been.
This was, I'll tell you, it was a few years ago.
I'm completely.
I'll have to find this for you. Yeah, it was. It was sort of like they're Intolerable Cruelty, where it's like you don't really think of it as being a Coen Brothers movie because it was so sort of out of the norm for them. What the heck was it?
I will while away the moments here while you're reading looking
please.
At the Wikipedia entry. By reading another email subject line, Dawn's doing that thing again. This email,
The Lady Killers is what
Lady Killer. I forgot that movie even existed.
Yeah.
By the way, just looking through my inbox, I see some of the greatest. Did you ever just scroll through your inbox and you see subject lines and whatever, and they just make you laugh? Like you sent me something. It was just called "Suck It" sound. Which I think is the thing from Robert Wagner.
Yeah.
But this says, Dawn is doing that thing again. And by that thing, and to be fair, it's not just about you. It actually is about, it's about Big Jim, as well as Jim Willig, who was in the studio the other day. But it says, Dawn and Jim are doing that thing again. Popeye was chased after by both Bluto and Brutus. Well, olive oil, really. Bluto was originally named Brutus, but due to copyright conflicts, they had to change the name, only to find out much later the copyright concern was all for naught. They could have kept his name Brutus, as it was in the initial cartoons, and then Scott Landerville had sent me a whole follow-up where he was tracing its origins back to a comic strip, and the comic strip was originally about olive oil, not about Popeye at all. He was an ancillary character who became the main character, and one of those things that, you know, in another universe where the listeners like hadn't answered it themselves would have become a pop culture authority. But last Friday, when I'm like, didn't Bluto's name used to be Brutus, and you and Jim like simultaneously in stereo, no? And I said, I thought that was the case. You're wrong! And then I was just shamed for the rest of the day, and I felt like less than a man. Apparently, it was not Rick Emerson that was wrong. It was Dawn, and to a lesser extent, Jim, who is incorrect in, quote, doing that thing again.
I mostly get emails from people telling me, offering me like little news items and things like that, and then as sort of an aside they say, you're doing a really great, don't let Rick grind you down. we're all supporting you when you stand up to him, and don't let him push you around. So yeah, apparently these are your listeners, these are your fans, and
well,
they email me now and go, good for you.
It's a complicated relationship. it's like when people meet my wife and they say, you are such a saint, you are such, I don't know how you do it, how do you really are a great, very tall, you work with crazy people, right? Well, that explains a lot. He's a handful, isn't he? You know, and you know, and meanwhile I just kind of, you know, I'm standing right here, I can hear everything you're saying.
Well, we were at the Fun Employment listener party, and Laura was standing with my husband, Patrick, and I can't remember, there was somebody else there who was, Fat Boy Robert's girlfriend, Bobby. And at some point they were talking about forming a support group for radio spouses.
The spouses, yeah. it is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Joining us tomorrow will be Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. He'll have a review of The Social Network. And on Thursday, the Oregonians, Anna Griffin at the news desk. This is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Let us do this penis watch, shall we?
Here's your penis watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Take a look at my enormous penis, and my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
Here's Dawn Taylor with your penis watch.
I would like to preface this by saying that I got this from an Indian news source. So as I read it, if the...
What kind of Indian are we talking about?
Turban Indian, not woo-woo Indian. So as I'm reading it, if the grammar and such seems a little...
tortured?
Stilted, that would explain why. But I'm just going to read it as written.
All right.
A woman in Australia was so enraged by her husband cheating on her that she believed setting fire to his penis would make him mend his ways. But Rajini Narayan, 46, did not realize that in her anger, she would bring about the death of her husband Satish, an engineer who designed ships for the Australian Navy. Narayan had confronted him about the affair at their Unley home near Adelaide after he gave her his email password and she found emails detailing the affair. She said, "You say you loved her? I'm going to burn your penis. I'm going to tell your family what you have done." Daily Telegraph quoted Lindy Powell, the defense, as telling the court.
I think it was like in that order, too. Like, she didn't even build up to the burning of the penis. It was like, first I'll burn your penis, then I'm going to speak ill of you to your friends and loved ones.
Yes, according to the defense attorney, after she said that, quote, he rolled away from her, turning his back on her. He said, "No, you won't, you fat, dumb bitch."
And then he went to sleep.
In that split second, in that highly emotional state, Narayan threw the petrol on her husband. She was so overcome, she simply lost her power to think and react rationally.
Wait, so she actually had it still in her hand. Look at this petrol. Look at this flame. I'm going to set your penis on fire. And then he said, what did he say? "You, no, you won't, you dumb bitch."
You fat, dumb bitch.
Oh, God.
Powell told the jury Narayan felt immediately remorseful and tried to save her husband of 24 years and the couple's three children, who were also in the house at the time. Narayan has pleaded not guilty to murdering her husband, who suffered burns to more than 75% of his body in the early hours of December 7th, 2008, and died in Royal Adelaide Hospital days later. Powell also said that Narayan had been subjected to years of physical and emotional abuse by her husband. Tim Preston, prosecuting, told the court that she had admitted her guilt to neighbors. "I did it. It wasn't an accident," she told a neighbor. The trial is continuing.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't expect that to go that way. I think that's the first setting fire to the penis story we've had. I mean, we've had a lot of harm done to penises on this program. Yeah. But I don't think we've had anything on that, using that particular methodology.
Yeah, I think if we've learned nothing from, say, Phil Hartman's murder, it is that when you have a fight with your crazy spouse, don't just turn your back on them and go to sleep.
Motel 6 is really where you're going to go that night. And, in an undisclosed part of town. Jesus. All right. There you go. There's your penis watch for Tuesday.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start melting away.
This song is more ironic sometimes than others.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
By the way, I played for my husband the little snippet from earlier this week when you opined that he seemed like a man who would be well endowed.
Well, look, I got to call him as I see him, or as I imagine them to be. What was his response?
This was while he was sick last night. He was laying on the couch, and he was just kind of going, "Thanks." I said, see, honey, we're talking about your penis on the radio.
Are you trying to cheer him up? I know you feel bad, but look, Rick thinks you have a huge schlong. So,
Pretty much.
It's a glass half full day, baby. All right, there you go.
How is this a penis watch, someone asked. She set his penis on fire.
Also, we followed it up by talking about Patrick's penis. I'm following that up, ill-advisedly, by talking about a brand new business partner, Squires Electric, who have the deepest kind of buyer's remorse, I would imagine. We want to welcome a brand new business partner, Squires Electric. You can find out more about them at squireselectric.com or at 503-252-1609. You can also go to rickemerson.com. You see their banner there. If you go there, it's a little clickable banner for Squires Electric at rickemerson.com or legionofnews.com. But here's what you need to know about them. If there's anything at your home or your business has to do with wires or wiring, they are there to make your life easier. And by easier, I mean not only easier, I mean also less deadly, because as Don noted, I am like the case study in the guy who should not be allowed. I mean, it's like at my home, it's astounding that they even have provided me theoretical access to, like, fuses or, like, breaker boxes or whatever, which I think are the same thing, but I'm not entirely sure. And then we mentioned during Legion of News, Joe Squires was saying that actually some of the biggest business he gets is people who buy a jacuzzi or a hot tub, and then they're unaware that you can't just take it home and just, like, stick it into, like, the power squid that's coming out of the wall or whatever.
I'm just having this vision in my mind now. In my head right now, there's this montage going on of you, like, you know, sticking a fork in the toaster, you know, and you've got, like, the wall ripped open, and you're just, like, sticking wires together and shocking yourself.
It's not too far from the... Well, because it's like... let me ask you this. It's just, have you ever...
Plugging in an iron, dropping it into the bathtub.
How else will it steam? But did you ever, like, just approach certain items in your home or areas of your home with just a sense of apprehension and dread. And this is what I'm thinking of specifically. I'm thinking of, like, the washer and dryer setup at my house, where it goes into, like, it's like this super plug. You know, it's like a plug that's like, it's not like a normal human plug. It's like some massive, like, extraterrestrial plug that then, like, doesn't go into a power, like, cord so much as it goes into, like, a cable that's, like, wrapped in steel casing or something. And
it's like a cartoon plug.
Right. Right. But then it's, like, hooked into a thing that just sloshes water around all the time. And there are moments. And then, have you ever done this? Have you ever, like, been walking around in your basement and you're on your way to something that uses power? Let's say it's the washer, the dryer, maybe the fuse box. And then you just realize that the basement, by definition, is, you know, because it's, by dint of just being underground, that it's damp and there's sort of a moisture in the air and sometimes small little, like, puddly areas. And you think to yourself, what are the number of things in this basement that are going to kill me if I touch them while, you know, my shoe is in, like, this small damp puddle that came because I was trying to wash too many things at once, you know, and the washing machine got overloaded with my boxer shorts.
Well, here's the thing, and I've put off telling the story, but I'll very briefly. When I bought my house was 100 years old, the house that I just recently sold. And I bought the house, and I should have probably had, like, an inspector come through and really tell me everything I was buying, but, you know, I really didn't. And I bought the house, and everything was actually pretty swell. They had been remodeling a lot of it. They hadn't rewired it yet, and so I still was using glass fuses, and that was bad enough. But then at one point, on the back porch, there was this giant knife switch, like a giant Frankenstein...
Like an on-off...
Knife switch, yeah, if you know what a knife switch is. And when my husband and I first started seeing each other, I was showing him around the house, he's like, what's this? And I said, it's just something left over from when, you know, before they rewired the house and stuff.
What does it do?
And he goes, what does it do? Does it turn off, like, the electricity? And I said, well, it couldn't possibly. I mean, that would be ridiculous. That's something, if you saw it in a movie, just wouldn't make sense. Like, somebody comes and they're going to, like, kill everyone in the family, and there's just one big switch on the back porch that turns off all the lights. So he, like, grabs it, and he flips it down, and sure enough, all the lights went off in the whole house.
Ah.
And that was the point. I was, like, going, wow, I should probably have somebody come in here to, like, rewire the joint.
Why would that even exist?
I don't know.
It's just like it doesn't make any sense that you would even have that around.
I know.
I mean, unless your house used to be a smelting plant or something, and there needs to be, like, I mean, it's there next to the emergency eye wash station or something.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the sort of stuff. Here's not
this
to get,
is this is and that's the sort of reason one of many reasons you need an electrician.
Seriously, and sometimes people will think that, well, if it's, you know, Squire's Electric, you know, it is they do condominiums and they do whole office buildings. Well, they did a whole condominium recently where it's like they put up the whole thing, and it's like you think about a condominium or any place like that where it's like every room has like 50 sockets and like. And, you know, the power outlets and, like, Ethernet wiring, and there's, like, the intercom so people can say, like, you know, if you ordered a package, you get it to the front desk or whatever, like, all that stuff. It's like Steve Martin and the Jerk where you realize there's just cans everywhere. There's just wires everywhere. And that all of them are filled with electricity that would like nothing better than just to kill you. Just to kill you dead. So that's why you need Squire's Electric. And, you know, also in your home. I don't mean to fill you with dread about walking into your own abode.
If you're not thinking about, like, how filthy your carpet is, think about how all of the wires will kill you.
How lethal every room in your home might be. But they actually have done, he says it's not even a figure of speech. He's actually done, like, a single light socket. He says there's no job too small because he figures, look, he goes to your house, he fixes, you know, or installs or repairs or maintains one plug, one outlet, one socket. You know, then you call them, you know, the next time you need two done, or three, or if you have a building, or if you're moving into a new house, you're having a house built. So you can find out more about Squire's Electric at squireselectric.com, 503-252-1609. You can tell me you heard it here on the Rick Emerson program, won't you please? And don't tell him you heard it on the Rick Emerson program just by saying penis over and over or something if he answers the phone. 503-252-1609, squireselectric.com, a brand new sponsor of the Rick Emerson Show, Squire's Electric. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. All right, so we should Well, we got the Peanut Watch on Snuff. We've got, man, we're on it today.
I know.
And we're not even running late. This is one of those
considering
days.
How bad the first show went. And the second one, like butter.
I don't think the first show went bad. It was just a little ragged initially, but I think that we got our stride. We found our rhythm pretty quickly, relatively. The thing I've learned, and the thing you and I have actually learned and shown many times just since we've been doing this iteration of the program, is that if it's like one of us is grumpy or agitated or whatever, like you can't just pretend it's not happening, because that never works. You just have to embrace it. You just have to sort of accept the fact that a little mini breakdown is happening inside your head or my head, as the case may be, and that something on NPR has just made you inexplicably furious, and you have to externalize. It's like, you know what it is? It's like when you've had too much to drink or you've had the wrong kind of food, and you just got to go hurl eventually, because that's the only thing that's going to rid of it. But we're actually really on time, and on a day where we really don't need to be, because I think Sarah and Greg
that's
actually
true.
Taped this morning, did they not?
They did. They were here this morning.
So I'm just saying, it's one of those things where it's like...
We could do something else if we wanted to.
We could go till 9 p.m., which we're not going to, but we could. That is the thing. That option is open to us. We have that have that privilege today.
From the text box, geez, one of you queens are always in a foul mood.
One of us, are you and I the two queens?
Yes, apparently we're queens, and one of us is always in a foul mood, and that's not true.
I'm just as the Lord created me. All right. It's 503-505-6964. Let's do a couple headlines here, then we'll talk Eastbound and Down, because you saw that last night. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Just because a guy makes sure that his belt and his shoes match, I mean, there's no need for name calling, all right? I mean, there's no need to be cruel about these things.
Last week's premiere of Running Wild from Arrested Development team Mitch Hurwitz and Will Arnett was met with a rather mixed critical reception, but Arnett believes the show's casting has a certain kind of magic.
You know, I would say for somebody, by the way, who takes the time to just, externalize a bunch of negativity in the text box, and then to be using that negativity to claim that one of us queens is always in a bad mood... I'm just saying. And I realized I did a real flamboyant hand gesture just now as I was saying that. And that my voice kind of got real high at the end.
It did. But, I believe you've made your point.
Have I? I've just become Paul Lynde. That's what I get for trying to insult the listener. I was just,
Yeah.
I'm not the one who's a queen, sir.
Working with
all right,
guy.
Here's is this Will Arnett?
This
is
be Will Arnett.
Will Arnett talking about Running Wild, which I haven't even seen. I heard about it.
I saw it.
Was it good?
It was, no, not really, but he is so good that it actually made it watchable just to watch him. It has potential, but it was pretty rough.
Let me ask you this, just real quick, before I play this soundbite. So this is Will Arnett, who played Joe Bluth. He did Arrested Development. He did this show called Sit Down, Shut Up, which was terrible. I hate to say this, but... has anybody considered the fact that Mitch Hurwitz just that maybe as well written as Arrested Development was, that maybe the lion's share of the magic there came from the directing and the acting, and the writing was maybe only 40% of that?
Yeah.
Because his other work has not impressed me so far.
Yeah, with this new show, they're going much broader, and they have him playing a very Joe Bluth kind of a character. So I think and I don't know.
Which is both good and bad. I mean, and I'm not saying everything has to be like Arrested Development.
Yeah.
I would like it to be good. And it doesn't seem like his other work has been very good. So this is Will Arnett talking about Running Wild.
Working with this cast, we're so lucky. It dawned on us, Mitch and I were driving back from work yesterday, and we were saying, wow, all these characters are really starting to become so different, interesting, and... it just came together. We have all these brilliant performers doing what they're really funny at, and we're so lucky. And we constantly get surprised because we've been so close to the process of this show for almost 2 years before we even started making the series, and just in the thinking about what we wanted to do and writing and stuff. And then seeing these guys come and girls come in and play and inhabit these parts and do way more and do stuff that we didn't even know. It's been
again with the talking on and on and on.
Yeah. So happy.
Did he say we have people doing what they're funny at?
Yeah.
And also we are constantly getting so surprised by what they do. He's maintaining the Bluthian syntax like far beyond the end of the show. Here's the brilliant and terrible thing about Arrested Development, and it goes beyond simple typecasting. It's not just that you hear the voice and you go, oh, it's the Joe Bluth guy, which is that. Didn't you make that movie like that? So you're going to prison movie or whatever.
Oh yeah,
which I never saw, and I only even saw
it
one.
Was terrible.
I didn't even like. I only ever saw one trailer for it, and then I never even like. And then it was released somewhere, and then it was gone. But it's like even the advertising was small for that.
And he was in. He was just in When in Rome this year. He
oh
was
God,
one,
really?
One of the many suitors of it, and he himself was not terrible, but the movie was so bad that there was just no saving it. Not even him. It was like. He couldn't even make his own character work. It was just, it's one of the worst movies that came out this year, and he was in it.
The problem with that guy specifically, more than anybody else on that show, although I did see, what's his name, Tony Blair? Is it possible that, Buster Bluth? Is it possible that his name is Tony Blair? Well, whatever. But the guy who plays Buster Bluth, he was on Justified. He was on an episode of Justified, and actually, you know, he was pretty good. I mean, he was, you know, he's playing a little bit of a nebbish, so kind of himself, just or you know himself, but kind of the same role to some degree. And then he's also in, not Adaptation. What's the Will Ferrell movie with Emma Thompson as the writer, where she's writing and he's in this Stranger Than Fiction.
Yeah.
So he's in that playing
Tony Hale.
Tony Hale, little variation on sort of you know the Buster Bluth thing, but really more of like an Office Space character. And he was actually really good in that. So the problem is not even so much with Arrested Development; it is specifically with Will Arnett. And here's what I realized: I saw this rerun of The Sopranos a while back where he's playing an FBI agent, and he's actually married to the FBI agent. I don't know if you watch The Sopranos, but he's married to the FBI agent who is she's going undercover. As Adriana's the Jersey girlfriend, and they're both FBI agents. They're married, and he's the husband. And he was doing this delivery, and he's putting on his tie in the morning, and they're both. And she's teasing her hair to go undercover, and he's just getting ready for day of the office, and he's putting on his shoulder holster, and he said, "You know, honey, you know, how are you doing at catching that mobster or whatever?" And it was just a straight, flat, serious, dramatic delivery, and I realized the genius of playing Joe Bluth is also his undoing. It's that Joe Bluth is never, ever, he has never, ever delivered a comedic line. They're all delivered dramatically. That's what makes Joe Bluth so great, is that even the laugh lines are delivered with the utmost seriousness. Everything he does, you know, it's like when Job tries to be funny, he fails. He is funny, and I'm getting it like it's an inside a thing. But, you know, the character of Joe Bluth, when he tries to be funny, it's lame because he's dumb.
Yeah.
But the comedy of the character comes from everything Job says is said as though everything Joe Bluth says is said like the final Schwarzenegger line before he kills the bad guy, where he says like, "Well, I guess you'll be letting off some steam then." Everything is said like the glib witticism before he dispatches the villain.
Yeah.
So now, when you hear Will Arnett doing a dramatic role or just speaking in a neutral voice, it sounds like Joe Bluth. And it took me a long time to figure out why he was so typecast. And it's the dramatic delivery. Which is too bad because the guy's obviously very gifted. And it's just you realize he can't play comedy without being compared to Joe Bluth. But he can't do a dramatic delivery without sounding like Joe Bluth. So he's kind of screwed on both ends. I don't know how you get out of that. I don't know how you get out of typecasting.
I don't know. Here, I'm trying to send you something here.
Is it bigger than a baby's arm?
It is.
Okay.
Hold on.
I gotta get the popcorn bed back just for when you're, This is Art waiting for Dawn to send me something, bed.
I have popped over into that.
All right, is it in the Dropbox?
Yeah, and it's a. I'll just put it right there. It's a. It's a link, and if you go there, what do you mean it can't?
Seems to be the boggle.
Oh, it. Apparently, if a thing is actually still open, you can't move it.
Okay.
There we go.
Do I need to?
No. Go ahead. That's a link. If you go to this particular Fox website, there's some clips and you get a hint of the dialogue
of the way that this of the way the show works.
Yeah.
All right. So I will that'll appear here in just a second. Okay. So let's do one more and then we'll play some of this. We'll talk Eastbound and Down and we'll wrap things up for today.
The mayor of the Mexican town of Tancítaro and his aide in Mexico were found stoned to death Monday on a dirt road in the drug-plagued state of Michoacán. 29-year-old Mayor Gustavo Sanchez was the fifth city leader to be killed in Mexico since mid-August. His aide, 36-year-old Rafael Cervantes, was also found in the back of an abandoned truck. Sanchez was not known to have a party affiliation and was a teacher by training before taking the helm of the town of 5,500. Last year, the city council chief, Gonzalo Paz, was kidnapped, tortured, and killed. Then in December, the mayor and seven other town officials resigned, saying they had been threatened by drug traffickers and local police were not showing up for work. In January, when Sanchez took the job of mayor, he fired 60 local police who were replaced by federal officers. More than 29,000 people have been killed in violence between rival drug cartels and between cartels and state security forces since President Felipe Calderon launched his offensive on cartels in 2006.
This is like that Onion story from last year where the headline was just Mexico killed in drug violence. Jesus. All right. Well, that is that a link? Because if it's a link, it's actually that is actually not appearing. So.
Oh, okay. Well, it's in the. There's some sort of. It's on the. It should be in the document. So I figured you could just cut it and paste it. So we're trying to work out this whole.
Here's the thing.
We're learning how to use this whole thing.
I'm right here. And I understand that this like this for file transfer. So Don and I use this. We use this thing called Dropbox to transfer files. But I'm saying, in a pinch, you could just.
Figured this would be faster than emailing it.
All right.
I thought.
All right.
But we're still learning to use this Dropbox, though.
Technology is... what kind of file is it? Is it like a document?
It's
like a
Word
document. All right.
If you don't see it, you don't see it. I would play it myself, but you know that we have that horrible buzzing problem with my computer making this loud, annoying humming sound that makes people start, like, hold their heads and scream.
It sounds to me as though God doesn't want us to play the audio,
yeah.
Don.
Okay,
it seems as though that's
we're
being foiled.
We won't play
I think
the audio.
A power greater than ourselves has intervened.
Yeah.
Hey, let me ask you this real quickly, just before we talk Eastbound and Down. I hate to be this guy. Is it, because we're inside a small, we're in a studio, inside a thing, inside a building, inside of whatever. Is it hot outside? Do you know? Do you have access to that information?
Yes, it's apparently it's 80-ish.
All right.
Supposedly.
The humidity was really
supposed to be high today, and it was this morning. It was very humid.
I'm not going to get bogged down in talking about the weather a lot because I don't want to be that guy, but it's another one of those things where every day now when I leave the house, it looks as though it could be 40 degrees or it could be like 105. Mm-hmm. And so I have once again chosen incorrectly. So hooray for me. Well, let's talk about Eastbound and Down, and then we'll wrap everything up and we can... revisit the Will Arnett Running Wild thing tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's part of our news audio there. What was I saying? Don't forget to join us, by the way, tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. He'll be having a review of The Social Network, which is the new David Fincher, Aaron Sorkin film about the founding of Facebook, which is said one of the best films of the year. Also, for you Think Geek enthusiasts, and I know there are many of you, if you purchase or long to purchase items from Think Geek, don't forget, all the way through the end of October, that is through October 31st, we got a discount code at ThinkGeek. The code is Emerson, E-M-E-R-S-O-N. So if you buy something through ThinkGeek, it gets you $5 off an order of $25 to $49 and $10 off an order of $50 or more. The code is good until midnight on Halloween. So that is Emerson, E-M-E-R-S-O-N. That's your discount code at ThinkGeek.com. All right. So Eastbound and Down, which
yes.
is a show starring Danny McBride, who you saw or probably didn't see in Land of the Lost last year. And it's done by Jody Hill, who did Observe and Report. He did The Foot Fist Way. And it's produced by Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, who is Will Ferrell's, the guy who directs most of Will Ferrell's movies, sort of the big movies he's done. And season two just started. And as I said yesterday, the only reason I even watch it is because you got me to watch Observe and Report. And then it was that thing of like, I must see everything he has ever made. And they do real short seasons. They only did 6 episodes of the first season. I don't know if they're doing only 6 episodes this year or not.
Yeah.
But
But the first 6 episodes of that first season, it was like this wonderful sort of long-ish feature film just unto
yeah.
itself. It's like they ended that season in such a way that if it had gone no further, you actually did have a sense of completion. It was just a really nicely told story.
They didn't even call them episodes, actually. They called them chapters. Mm-hmm. If you see it, if you get it on DVD, if you get it on demand or whatever, it actually is Eastbound and Down, Chapter 1. They obviously viewed it as being something that could be a self-contained story if necessary, because I think they were really unclear about whether it was going to be renewed for a second season. So just... And there's no spoilers here. I will say that if you're not watching it, you really ought to watch it. It's a great show. It is about It's about a Major League Baseball player who's sort of like a fifth stringer, who lucks, who just stumbles into becoming, he's a relief pitcher, but like the ninth guy that you call up. And everybody else is injured, and he stumbles into pitching like a winning the game or pitching a perfect game or something. But he's just like a fat, drunken, jackass idiot who trips and falls into stardom and then blows it immediately because he's just such a raging dick. And now is broke and, you know, the broken on the skids. And trying to regain his former glory. And as a result of a whole bunch of misunderstandings and mishaps, most of which are his own fault, he is now living under an assumed identity in Mexico.
Yes.
Now, he's living as Steve something or other. Is that his brother, or is that just some guy?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
I think it's his brother.
I think they just thought it was funny that he was just called Steve.
Yeah, but it's like when he goes to withdraw pesos from the ATM, it's like Stephen Marklowski or something.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's his brother. I think it's like he's just stolen somebody's identity somehow. But you were talking about how it's made to look like a feature film. I mean, even though it's ostensibly a sitcom, there's no audience or anything. It's not filmed live. But it's a 30-minute comedy on HBO, and it's not shot like, you know, like most comedies. You noted that Dexter was shot in a really crude, sort of ham-handed fashion, that Dexter just was done really, just really shoddily. I mean, there was just no imagination or thought or wit or style that went into the filming of Dexter, which presumably has a bigger budget and bigger stars and more viewers. And then you watch Eastbound and Down, and it's shot like an epic film.
Yeah, it's just it looks gorgeous. And that's another thing that struck me is that I realized when I was watching it too that, again, I started thinking of Dexter, and even just the visuals on Dexter were just kind of muddy and uninspired, and it's like they got really bored. Whereas there's this energy to everything that Jody Hill does, where you can tell they're just really thinking about what they're doing really hard, and they're really enjoying the hell out of what they're making.
And it's got a grandeur to it,
and it's just beautifully crafted. I mean, I don't even know how to explain it other than the fact that you get so used to a certain kind of pacing and direction and editing in television, even in like the good cable shows. And then this is done like a feature film.
Yeah.
It's really beautifully done. And plus, and then the cat, we're once again back with Kenny Powers, who is,
he's just the worst.
Inexplicable, because he's a completely vile human
being.
There's
nothing good about him. He has essentially no redeeming qualities, and you should loathe him. And yet, I'm watching the show, you know, every week, and sort of liking him is maybe the wrong way even to put it. I don't even know how to describe it. I know that we're doing a total disservice because it's like you have to see it. It can't be explained.
Yeah, we should have actually gotten some audio clips from this so we could play, because the other thing about Eastbound and Down, much like with Observe and Report, the other things they've done, it's the dialogue. The dialogue is just genius.
Yeah.
The things that everyone says are just so sharp and so perfect. You know, and Kenny Powers himself has just this amazing dialogue that within the scope of just like a few sentences of dialogue, he'll be racist, he'll be offensive in some horribly graphic way. He will also be sort of endearing because of his completely, you know, delusional ego. But at the same time, there's this part of that you actually find him almost kind of adorable.
Because he's so clueless, and because there's like no guile with Kenny Powers either, is that everything you see, even though he just treats people horribly and swindles people and takes advantage of people, but swindle is even the wrong way to put it. He's just sort of upfront about it. He's not even cunning or clever. He's just, like, we've all known a guy like that, too. He is sort of an exaggerated version of somebody we have all known who is just a vampire, like, in every way. But it's because...
It also comes from just the ego. Like, there's the scene where he's sitting in this cantina, and his new helper, his new fellow he's hanging out
with
is this horrible little Hispanic dwarf guy. And then there's another guy there, and there's a scene where he's telling the guy what a great sidekick he is. And you're a much better sidekick than this guy. You know, he's beating you out as a sidekick, Manuel. And the dwarf guy is telling him he doesn't speak any English.
actually, in the first episode of the second season, actually, the great moment is, I mean, they're all great, but one of the great moments is a climax is at the end with him actually saying, And because his whole thing is he's trying to engineer his return to Major League Baseball by playing on a Mexican baseball team. And he says, and then I will be acknowledged as the Christ figure that I am. And he puts his arms out in a Jesus pose and leans back like to absorb the sun's rays in an actual literal Jesus Christ pose and just flat out refers to himself as a Jesus figure, but like with no sense of irony at all.
After having ridden onto the field on his moped and then proven that he is who he is by showing them his rookie card.
That it's worth $5 on eBay, so give it back.
Yeah.
He is... In some weird way, he's like a cousin to some character from Arrested Development. I mean, he is almost like Jobian in that way. He's like some horrible real world beer swilling, big gut mullet wearing version of Joe Bluth, who just is completely deluded about his own abilities and how people view him. There's a sequence where Kenny Powers is imagining how everybody is sad now that he's on the run. He's missing. He's vanished to Mexico, and he says something. This isn't it, but he says something in like, you know, the warm blanket named Kenny Powers is no longer there to cover the cold spot in their hearts, and their lives are a little darker and empty. And meanwhile, it's this montage of everyone he has ever known living the most fantastic and wonderful, carefree life now that he's gone. And as you're right, but it's done in this like slow motion with these and. This is where if I was a big film nerd, because I really don't know that much about film, I would be able to talk about like what kind of lenses or whatever they're using. Because it's the big widescreen. You know, I mean, it looks like a feature movie and a feature film. And the thing is, and I was watching it not just as a television show, I was watching it on my laptop. Yeah. I mean, I'm watching it on my laptop and it feels like you're sitting in a theater.
It's the way everything is framed is very much more like a feature film than there aren't a lot of tight shots like there are in TV. TV, a lot of TV is edited with a lot of tight close-ups of you know, just headshots, one or two shots. This is all much bigger and pulled back. It is shot very much like a feature film, but also just the actual look of it itself. And one of the things that's that I keep noticing is like pretty much everything anymore is shot on digital video,
right?
Not on film. But there are ways to make the digital video look more film-like. And before I watched Eastbound and Down, I had watched the second episode of Boardwalk Empire. The first episode was directed by Martin Scorsese, and I never thought for a moment one way or the other about it being on digital video or not. The second episode, there kept being these moments where I suddenly would become aware that it was. They would do these things to give it a film-like quality, but one of the weaknesses with digital video is particularly in scenes where you're panning the camera. When there's movement of the camera, it's like it breaks down, and you're suddenly aware that you're looking
like
at video.
It looks like VHS almost for a minute.
And there were a couple of moments in Boardwalk Empire that were like that, which were really kind of jarring because the art direction on that is so sort of lush and cinematic, and it's, you know, and the thing is, I never had a single moment like that in Eastbound and Down.
And it's, you know, he's so, now we're just being total film wankers, but what are you going to do? That's just, you know, it is what it is. The Shield would do that occasionally because it was on digital video, but they do that thing of replicating the 24 frames per second rate where it looks, because the thing, as it was explained to me, is that video actually looks almost too lifelike, and you're used to film, which is a somewhat degraded version of reality. But yeah, when you do the panning and the scanning in a shot, it suddenly, it pulls you out because the quality, and I don't know why that is. It's something about how it can't process the image or something. He avoids that largely in his films and in Eastbound and Down because he doesn't do a lot of fast cuts. In fact, it's the opposite, where all of those moments are slowed down.
Well, he doesn't move the camera a lot. He has a lot of static shots, and then just sort of, you know, editing, you know, in and around. You know, his pacing of his editing is also just really, really brilliant. Because you had mentioned this yesterday about the cockfighting scenes, which aren't actually graphic really at all.
But doesn't it seem, when you were watching it, though, didn't you have a moment? I mean, maybe not, because I'd already prepped you for it, but I had a moment where I was thinking, like, how are they filming this? Is this real? It looks kind of like real cockfighting.
But if you go back and you look at it, you've got, you know, kind of the roosters going at each other. They're kind of pecking at each other and doing whatever. But it's really very quick. And then you don't really see anything else. It's all crowd.
You think you see.
It's crowd reactions. And then at the end, after one of the roosters has ostensibly been killed, you see the triumphant rooster kind of pecking at
right.
the dead body of the rooster, which could very well...
A feather duster.
Yeah, a fake rooster. So you don't actually see any actual violence. It's just all... very artfully.
It's the psycho shower scene violence.
You're filling it in your own head.
How great is it, by the way? And then we should probably wrap this up. Because the thing is, without Sarah and Greg here to be like sort of a governor on our time, I mean, we would just sit and just talk. We would just nerd ourselves until midnight. But how great is it that the show actually opens, this episode opens with him, first of all, at a cockfight, which is a really jarring image. And then it's Kenny Powers, who's just like fat and greasy with a cornrowed mullet.
Yeah.
And he's got fistfuls of, like, literally fistfuls of dollars, fistfuls of, like,
pesos.
And he's just, like, in slow motion, like, doing a triumphant, like almost like a hula-hooping motion back and forth, like a twisting. And, like, I cannot believe my good fortune in slow motion. And just, like, and that just tells you everything you need to know about the character. He's just won a lot of money at a cockfight in Mexico. He's a big, fat, greasy white guy with cornrowed mullet hair. And he's just a man without shame or class in any way. And then Jody Hill has one of his many trademarks. One is the slowed down music, and one is the sort of, you know, the epic entrance to a thing that is presumably not that epic, like entering the ring for a cockfight or whatever. But then it's that thing where the credits, he does the jump cut to the credits, and they just slam into the screen. And it's just so freaking brilliant.
Very movie-like credits. Very, very like Quentin Tarantino-style, kind of, you know, old grindhouse-style B-movie credits.
It's odd. I have to
not TV credits.
It sounds like such a cliche to call it a breath of fresh air, but you said when you get even the creative shows, like as much as I love Mad Men, it's not like there's, and I'm not for tricky camera work for its own sake, because then you're just some dick trying to show off. Then you're some guy from art school. But it's just about finding a different way to do things, or not just doing it the way it's always been done, finding a different way, but a different way that works. Mad Men is a pretty conventional show in the way that it uses the camera. The production design is beautiful, but the camera, it does what it does, and that's fine. But you get so used to not seeing anything that challenges your expectations. And then you watch Eastbound and Down, or for me, when I watched Observe and Report, I mean, the end of Observe and Report, I've told the story, but it ended, and I had not, even with your description, I didn't know what to expect, and it ended, and it just did that, you know, like, shot of him at for no reason, except that it just feels correct. It ends with a shot of Seth Rogen at the firing range going and just unloading the gun. And then it just says, observe and report. And then it just went to the credits. And it ended. And I just sat there and I just didn't even talk for 2 or 3 minutes. And I just felt like exhilarated. I had this rush at the end. It was like going to some manic stage or something, but just from the editing of the film. And it's like, and that's all about the way that guy cut. You were talking earlier about Tarantino's editor who was found dead yesterday, this morning. And that's up with this guy, too. And I don't know if he does he edit his own stuff, do you think? Or
I don't know who edits for him.
You got to watch it. And if you're not watching Eastbound and Down, you should. If you don't have HBO, you can get the first season on DVD. If you can't get the first season on DVD for whatever reason, you got to watch Observe and Report. And I'm going to get the Foot Fist Way tonight because I've never seen that. So it really is just, it is quite something. It is, because you get a little bit jaded about these things even now where you feel like, well, that's it. There are no more good programs to watch. Everything's been done. You know, The Wire's off the air and Mad Men's almost wrapped up the season. There will be nothing. It's a wasteland.
Nobody's doing anything new. It's all crap. And then, but no.
See, and that is just not my final thing probably ever, but that a show like Eastbound and Down or Mad Men, which was rejected. HBO didn't even reject it. They wouldn't even read the pilot. They'd even get back to it. Matthew Weiner's like, hey, can you read my pilot? And they said no. And so he took it to AMC. The thing about Eastbound and Down is you watch that and you realize, like, there is no excuse for making bad television. Like, that guy's got, I mean, Will Ferrell producing it or not, it's not like they're giving him a lot of money. I mean, Will Ferrell's name got it on the air, but it's not like he's got a truckload of cash to do it.
And there is so much bad television this year. The networks, you know, are rolling out all of their fall stuff, and it's almost all bad.
Yeah.
Not even just mediocre, but bad. And it's hard to understand why. There's not a dearth of talent out there, and there certainly isn't a lack of people who want to do something interesting and new. So the only explanation is that it's just the system of executives who have absolutely no ability to think about how to do anything except for the way it's always been done before.
And it's not even the money, because as you were noting with digital video, I mean, it's like the cost of shooting and making a movie or a television show, you know, has dropped to like, I mean, Spike Lee's maybe, you know, a bad example because he's been bootstrapping it for so long that he knows how to make movies really cheaply anyway. But I remember when I first saw, you know, this is years ago now, when I saw Bamboozled, and then I watched the director's commentary and he revealed that Bamboozled, which, it was a theatrical release. It wasn't like it was some direct-to-DVD thing. It was made with the camcorders he literally got at Shopko. He went and he bought like six cameras at Shopko. And so you can make a movie for like a hundredth of what it used to cost. You're right. It's just, it is like the insistence of, and this is rampant in all forms of media and entertainment, this aversion to doing anything that is in any way slightly different than what you have ever done before, which is just like a recipe, for just making dreck and boring dreck. It's not even interesting bad. It's just dull bad. Not unlike this program, which is glorious.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you know what I'll do? Tomorrow, I will bring in some audio from Eastbound and Down, because I want to know if Aaron watches that. Aaron Mesh will be here to talk about Social Network. And it will play some audio from Running Wild, because I would like to know more about that.
We should make sure you have your iPhone out so we can snap a picture of Aaron so everyone can see the giant mustache we always talk about.
The thing is, I bet he'll thwart us. I bet he'll thwart us by getting rid of it.
Mm.
Will I have my phone? We'll ambush him with that as soon as he comes in the door. All right. Awesome. Anything else to say? Final thoughts, observations?
Can't really think of a thing at this point. I'm all used up.
All right.
It's been a tough couple of hours here.
Let's see. Join us tomorrow when our guest will be Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. And Thursday, we'll talk to Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. And
Friday, we may be having another Snack Food Friday.
With Sarah and Greg.
Sarah and Greg.
And I think we discovered last night what our food's going to be.
Yes.
I feel pretty good about that choice.
Yeah.
Because we did potato chips that week and Doritos and whatever. And then we did, like, Triscuits.
Mm-hmm.
Which are still, you brought cream cheese today, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you know, there's still some Triscuits in the cupboard in there, too.
And there's bagels from Kettleman's.
Awesome. So I think this Friday we're going to do another little crossover segment with Fun Employment Radio, and we'll have another, we'll just spoil our palates with all kinds of, you know, the horrible yet improbably delicious foodstuffs. So that'll be this Friday, and we'll also have an announcement this Friday about our giveaways from ThinkGeek.com. So that's all on the way. So forth. So we're going to wrap this show up. Here's what will happen. We'll end this program. We'll have a little musical interlude, which, just because we can, we're going to feature The Hero by Queen, because that was in Observe and Report, and so that's been going through my head during this conversation. We'll have a little Queen. From the two queens, apparently. We'll have an encore of today's Legion of News episode, so you can enjoy the genius all over again, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program, and that will happen, that'll loop kind of throughout the next 20 hours or so. We'll see you again tomorrow at 1 p.m., and we'll see you at noon before that at pdx.fm for Legion of News. So in the meantime, in between time, we thank you for listening. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor, executive producer Bruce Agnew. Advanced Technology and Magic provided by Thomas Gill, and Chief of Staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Tuesday, September 28th, 2010, and that is the frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. Bye now.
The proceeding was a production of the Emerson News Network.